Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 99 of Dominario's Judgment, a weekly Game of Thrones Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And today we have two very different formats and tournaments to get to here. We have the Modern Mocks with a side dish of Vintage Cube that took place over the weekend, and then a whole lot of Pioneer decks and results and tournaments to cover ahead of the RCs starting in just a few weeks. But I think that it might make sense to start with our Nonsense of the Week segment, which this week is going to be basically the entire mock somehow, again.
Well, hold up. The mocks has some nonsense. There is other real nonsense that we have saved for the end that yes. is better than the mocks nonsense. But do you think an 8-person event where 2 players played Infect is a representative sample of the modern metagame?
No. There is a larger question there about how representative can an 8-person tournament for a format as open as modern, like, can that ever really be the case? Like, you're often going to have, especially if people in the tournament are working together, which is what we often see. Like, if 2 people decide to work together and they end up on the same deck, that automatically is at least 25% of the field and going to have a big impact on how that portion of the tournament plays out. So even in the dark, if you don't know anything about your fellow competitors, then just the usual testing process for a tournament, with that small of a field, you lead to these very wacky outcomes that wouldn't necessarily be replicated in a 400-person field. And then if you do know stuff about your competitors, which was certainly the case here, well, then things just go completely off the rails.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was the one mox where, like, wasn't it Allura's Death Shadow Finals mirror that was pretty representative? But yes, I agree.
Yeah, so that was the Tangrams versus Nathan Story Finals, where Nathan won one of his several mox trophies there. And that kind of makes sense, right? You have 2 elite players testing together, playing a good list of the best deck. But even there was some nonsense afoot. So, for example, they knew that Belchabov, Ball 49, was going to be in that tournament. And so they came packing Mindgrind in their sideboard, just this 3-mana auto-win button for that specific matchup. Something that you really could not justify doing in anything approaching an open modern field, even if Belcher had just had a good weekend and maybe you would overcorrect for that a little bit. With this tournament, if you know that one person is going to be on one deck, well, it actually makes a lot of sense strategically to target that person with as narrow and effective as tools as you can get your hands on. And in the modern card pool, if you want to hate someone out, you can hate someone out. And that is maybe nowhere more true than in the case of Mill, which was a story for this tournament, because when Tybalt of Red Sub won the Modern Showcase with Mill to qualify for this tournament, they knew, and everyone else knew, they were going to play Mill in this tournament. And on that day, months ago at this point, it was locked in. There were going to be combined, like, double-digit copies of Emrakul the Aeon's Torn and Kozlik the, not the Great Distortion, the original one, whatever that one was called. There were going to be more reshuffle Eldrazis in this tournament than maybe any tournament that we've ever seen before, including ones where those cards were actually cards you wanted to put in your modern decks.
Yeah, I really appreciate the fact that, like, both of the creativity decks in this tournament just escalated beyond, we are having an Emrakul. It's like, no. The Emrakul might get surgical extracted. One of us is going to show up with an Ulamog too, and the other is going to have Gaia's Blessing.
Yeah, and that makes sense, honestly. And given that, you know, let's say you knew there was going to be one copy of, to use the example from before, Belcher in this tournament. Well, if you want to hard target that one person, you probably have to use several slots to do that, unless your deck just has some tutoring effects or really good card manipulation, or you think the matchup is decent as it is and you just want to push it over the edge a little bit. With Mill, you just need those cards to exist on your deck list, and automatically you have massively upgraded your Mill matchup. And so, yeah, the Infect decks both have a copy of Emrakul in the sideboard. Julian Jakubowicz, The Bean, and Bernas Torres worked together, and so they submitted the same list, including the one copy of Emrakul on the sideboard. The Hammer deck has the sideboard Emrakul, which was obligatory for this tournament, but also they went with the Amirius Cool Solitude version of Mono White Hammer, which I have to imagine that choice was partly informed by that version just being better against Mill in game 1 on the back of just having the card Amirius Cool in your deck, which is not what it's there for, but it can't hurt, especially here. And then Carl Sarup, who ended up on Eldrazi Tron, and that's going to be a story to focus on in its own right, he ended up with a main deck, Kozlek Butcher of Truth, there we go, which in your Eldrazi Tron deck, which has like the Tron and Eldrazi Temple, you can actually cast that as a spell against other decks sometimes. Like, it's not impossible. And then, funnily enough, the only deck in this tournament that doesn't have an Emrakul or a similar card in its summer is the Gory's Vengeance Reanimator deck, which, you know, we're going to figure that one out through other means. But then, yeah, as you mentioned, the Emrakul deck that Sean Goddard, aka Beekeeper on Magic Online, took to second place, an Emrakul and an Ulamog in the sideboard there, and then Tom White, McQuinn Sources Creativity deck, an Emrakul and a Gaia's Blessing. Interestingly, there was some debate for Sean over, is he meant to board in the Eldrazi and kind of transform his creativity hits against anyone else? And I think against a format at large, there's a good reason that you don't see many people actually trying to creativity into Emrakul the way you did going on 2 years ago at this point. Just too many Solitudes running around, too easy to get that card trumped by stuff like Teferi or even random stuff like Odawara and so on for no effect. But again, specifically, the Eldrazi Tron deck that has Orvar in its sideboard from Carl Sarup, I think that switch actually makes sense there in a way that it wouldn't against basically anybody else. The other thing about Mill as the known deck for this tournament, as opposed to the Belcher and so on of Mox's past, is that those locked-in choices in the past, there's kind of this first mover effect where if you declare openly, I am locking in this deck, it's kind of the constructed equivalent of declaring I am going to force a certain color combination in a draft, where everyone else, even if they think your choice is kind of silly or random, they at least have to factor that into their own decision making. So yeah, if you know there's going to be a copy of Belcher in the mox, it's pretty hard to justify playing a deck that just strategically folds to Belcher. Whereas in the case of Mill, it almost doesn't matter how bad your game on matchup is, you can buy back a ton of equity there by just having enough of these high-cost reshuffle effects in your sideboard. And so, yeah, I think the Hammer matchup organically is incredible for Mill, but you can still play Hammer in the tournament as long as you're willing to devote the two or three slots in your sideboard to flipping that from a 20% to an 80%.
Yeah, I mean, the Hammer player 2-0 Mill in the first round.
And yes.
I kind of get the impression that this, like, declaring what you are going to play in an 8-player field is also declaring that you're going to lose, almost.
Yes, and this is the worst deck to declare that with, and yet, I mean, it would have been amazing if, after all of this, Tybalt showed up with, I don't know, like, Blue Eye Control or something, or some other choice, which, it almost doesn't matter what it would have been, it would have out-leveled the format, or the field in that sense, but they knew, and we knew, that they're a Mill main, as they so brilliantly put it in their responses to the player profile. Please describe your playstyle in 1 to 2 sentences. I only use LO. Life is LO. Brackets. In Japanese, Mill is called LO, which stands for Library Out. Then follow-up, when did you start playing Magic? Scourge. Brackets. Raven Guildmaster, one of the all-time iconic LO cards. And then, what are your hobbies and passions in life outside of Magic? I'm not really interested in much else except LO. And so at that point, your flag is firmly planted. There is no hope that you're going to play anything else. And you know that, and the rest of the field knows that too.
It's just a personal brand equity play. You know, if you think that's a higher equity play than playing a deck that is less predictable, go ahead. But I guess maybe this whole, like, how extreme is it, is maybe wrong, because the deck that won the event was a predictable choice. Like, the player playing it was in the leagues with the deck before deck submission. And that's the sort of fair Goryeo's Vengeance deck that kind of, I don't recall seeing a lot of lists that were quite exactly this way. This is Marco Vassallo playing with Fables and Leyline Bindings alongside Shadow Prophecy. And if I remember correctly, most of the previous lists were sort of more condensed towards three colors the last time we really saw this.
Yeah, so this choice was predictable in the sense that True Hero, aka Marco, had been streaming this deck a bit, posting about it on Twitter, and if you check their Goldfish page, this would have shown up from a few months ago. So this was a known quantity. On the other hand, if you had said, there's going to be a copy of this deck in the tournament and it's going to win, that by itself would have come as a surprise, because this deck has, after that initial wave of hype when Attracts release, basically fell completely off the face of the earth. And I don't know if this finish is going to put it back on the map, if other people are going to pick up this ball and run with it now. But the fact that this was A, registered, and B, victorious in the tournament deserves some consideration. So yeah, this is a kind of slower, more resilient list with the kind of domain sub theme. We have not only Leyline Binding as our interaction spell of choice, We also have Shadow Prophecy. So this is the instant speed, like, read the bones, painful true style effect that crucially puts the cards that you don't take into your graveyard. And so this is the thing that finds your Goryeo's Vengeance, or if you need an emergency Solitude or something like that, you have pretty good odds of finding it, but can, in the same motion, dump that Atraxa or the Grizzlebrand in the graveyard. So it's a good enabler there. And this deck is really not aiming to combo quickly, and when it needs to, it's not that good at that. So we've had these Goryeo Vengeance decks in the past where turn two is taking your turn off to dump something in the graveyard and then setting up for the turn three Goryeo's Vengeance. And then some of the, like, Asmo Cookbook Goryeo's Vengeance decks can do that as early as turn two with the Cookbook into Vengeance curve. With this deck, you only have the four Tainted Indulgence to get your Legend in the graveyard that early. There's no Faithful Mending or anything like that. And then you have both Shadow Prophecy and Fable of the Mirrorbreaker, which are these amazing glue cards, but they kind of set you up for this turn four combo finish, and you have the cards like Binding and Solitude and Grief or Solitude with Ephemerae as this subplot to the entire deck, which can buy you time to get there. So we're optimizing for resiliency rather than speed. And so in that sense, this reminds me more of a creativity style deck as opposed to something like a classic like Grizzlebrand combo deck or something of that nature.
Yeah, the absence of Faithful Mending is very important here, because this is sort of declaring that it's a no bad cards deck. Like, the only bad card is effectively, you know, your bad card slot is being spent on, you could call Ephemerate or Goryeo's Vengeance a bad card, or maybe your creatures, but like, there's no auxiliary bad cards, and Ephemerate is your scam setup, so like, you just aren't putting yourself down cards with Mending. I don't know. That was sort of my impression playing against the three color versions of this deck, is that Faithful Mending is just not a good Magic card. We just have like gotten to the point where everyone knows how to put good Magic cards in their deck. So every time you cast Faithful Mending and don't immediately cast a Goryeo's, you lose the game basically.
Yeah, my issue with that deck before was you're already throwing away so many cards to your evoke creatures, and then Ephemerate as well if you're going with that angle. If you're having to interact with them and trade one for one, you're just throwing cards into the void to the point where by the time you cast Faithful Mending, you maybe only have two or three cards left over, and then the act of casting Mending is itself putting you down a card, and so you just run out of cards so quickly, and in a deck which is good at playing a low resource game, then that would be an acceptable trade-off to make. In this deck, unless you have the Goryeo's Vengeance as the ideal follow-up and the Atraxa or the Grizzlebrand in the right zone for it, you're left just with these random like Uno cards that you can't do anything with, and so you just spin your tires and the opponent has all the time in the world to get out of it. So this slower, more resilient approach might actually be the way to go there. I would say Tainted Indulgence is over the line of being a bad card for me, but it is actually better in the draw two cards mode in this deck, which between Shadow Prophecy filling your graveyard and this more diversified spread of casting costs, you can actually get to that threshold more reliably if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, it is at least a functional card that when you cast it does not put you down raw resources. You'll also notice, like, previous lists of this deck have had Priest of Fell Rites, and that's just like not in this deck. We're really only interested in the very specific Goryeo setup. We're not playing Priest as a backup, and I do kind of wonder if there's maybe room for a very small number of that, but at the same time, like, this deck is also just very well set up to completely ignore Unholy Heats and similar cheap removal, so you may as well just not go down that road and accept that, like, they'll throw that at your Fable token and who cares.
Yeah, I did like the priests in some of the previous builds, but they really encourage you to have the curve of turn two priest into turn three some way to get your legend in the graveyard, and Shadow Prophecy can be that, but maybe not reliably. Fable notably can't be that, because the earliest that's pitching something away for you is turn four, and so you could build a list, I think, that has priests and has some of these other cheaper enablers, but then you're committing somewhere closer to like 8 to 10 slots instead of just the 3 to 4, and at that point you're effectively a different variant of the same deck. So moving beyond that, we should talk about Carl, and we should talk about Eldrazi Tron. And this is this even an Eldrazi Tron deck anymore? Like, a lot of the Eldrazi have worked their way out of this list.
There's four Eldrazi Temple, and there's still Mata Reshaper, so like, you know, what else would it be? I don't know how there's still Mata Reshaper, but it's here.
Okay, there are only two Mata Reshapers, which is
more than zero. It's more than zero.
Yes, perhaps two more than there should be, and yes. There are more match reshapers in this list than there are reality smashers, which used to be like this hallmark threat of the deck and one of the reasons to play it, and it's a sign of just how much things have changed and how poorly some of these cards have aged that, like, we have... I'm not sure what the thought process was that arrived at exactly one copy of Reality Smasher, but that sure is where we ended up.
Yeah, I think that there might be more argument for more Smashers in a less constrained metagame. I think we'll get to talking about this somewhat in the rest of the modern metagame later, but it's a reasonable time just to be playing arbitrary large creature threats. But in a metagame where you are like sort of sitting down and being like, okay, well, one player has been seen recently playing Goryeo's Vengeance. One player has been recently seen playing Hammer. One player is going to play Mill. Smasher is like fine, but just like play a card that might work and be better. And like these inscribed tablets giving you a better chance of having a good hand. Like, all this other stuff is just so much better.
Notably, this list seems a lot more reliant on actually hitting Tron. So, the top end here, compared to the usual Eldrazi Tron package of, like, you have your kind of great creators, and then maybe some mix of, like, other Planeswalkers or some of the more expensive Eldrazi. Carl has the Co-Select, three mentioned, a Cityscape Leveler, an Ugin the Spirit Dragon, two Ugin the Ineffable as a six drop, and also an All-Star. So, this is a lot of stuff which, if your hand is like two Tron pieces, Eldrazi Temple, you really need to hit that third Tron piece or have a route towards that, or those are going to be sitting there for quite some time. So I think this is a bet on him having more time to do that. So he will have more time to assemble Tron, and his ways of assembling Tron are going to be interacted with less, and also a statement that he feels he needs these heavy hitters to go toe-to-toe with the better late game of something like the creativity decks, or if there's any like four color Omnath deck, stuff like that in the field. You kind of want these heavy hitters there, and you're going to have more time to get to that point. But on the whole, I think if you showed this list to most Eldrazi Tron pilots, they would be like pretty alarmed at the direction it's taking, because this is very, very, very unconventional, I would say.
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense in that, like, if the replacement level Eldrazi threats are getting worse and worse, but Karn and Thoughtnot Seer are still good, you should build a deck that is either aiming to cast one of those two cards in your non-Tron games, or trying to maximize your Tron games to do something actually bigger.
I can kind of get behind that, yeah. Notably as well, there's a main deck Filigree Silex and two sideboard Ratchet Bombs. So I think these are one way to keep up with decks like Hammer or Scales, if that's a thing. That was, you know, the beneficiary of this like hype cycle that coincided with when decklist submission would have been. But also against at least one known creativity deck in the field, and perhaps two, this is one of the best ways to hedge against that. And you also see three main deck copies of Warping Whale, which good against creativity, also good against any flavor of Cascade deck that may come to the table too.
Yeah, I think there, like, the Filigree Silex as well is good against Rhinos, and there's like some expectation that you're going to play against that. And also, sure, like, there's only so bad playing a main deck Ratchet Bomb can be if you expect one of the players to be showing up with Hammer.
That's fair as well. So yeah, that's actually like a pretty flexible choice, and not the last time we will be singing the praises of Ratchet Bomb / Filigree Silex in this episode, I think. So Carl choosing Eldrazi Tron is an interesting story, because my understanding of how this went is that when Carl was testing for the previous marks that he qualified for, where he ended up playing Domain Zoo, which we have had our issues with that deck in the past as well, but in the course of that process, one of the known locking decks for that tournament was an opposing copy of Eldrazi Tron. And so when they were testing their own candidate decks for the tournament, they would test everything against Eldrazi Tron, and Eldrazi Tron was just smushing all of them. And so they kept daring Carl to just suck it up and register Eldrazi Tron himself. Didn't follow through for that tournament, but for this one, maybe this started as a frontrunner.
Yeah, I'm going to be interested to try out this new list. Like, the number of times I have, like, the ability to turn three Matter Reshaper off an Urza's Tower is lower, so I might actually get through a league and not just, like, write the deck off as a joke after two matches. But it feels like it is moving in the correct direction.
As yet another reminder of this, Eldrazi Tron was, according to internal data, the most winning deck on Magic Online for a solid 2 or 3 years at a period when everybody else wrote it off as a joke. So maybe we were the joke the whole time. Maybe they knew something we didn't, and maybe Carl knew something we didn't for this tournament, although it did not, in fact, go his way. There were some quite hilarious games on camera where Carl, you know, there was one game where he kept two Tron pieces, exposition map, and then some big payoffs against creativity, and then the map got spell pierced and he basically took no further game actions in that game. And then also a few games against Infect where his hand was as slow as molasses, and the first relevant play was like, I guess Chalice of the Void is a relevant play, but then that was building towards turn four Ballista for two, but in the very like slow and hobbled game that the Chalice had created, that Walking Ballista was like this imposing threat that just dominated the game by itself.
Yeah, I don't think the Phyrexian Crusader players were well prepared for a colorless thing that shoots your creatures. They were very well prepared for these creativity lists that just can literally never kill the card unless they resolve creativity. But I don't know, looping back to the whole Infect thing, I am just extremely generally underwhelmed with that deck these days. Even if you think that Phyrexian Crusader is at its absolute peak and will never get better, and like maybe you expect the metagame to be relatively light on things like Scam or Murktide that are pretty good at shredding all of your stuff, and also like your deck cannot beat a Blood Moon in its current configuration. I don't know, even with all of that, it's like you struggle to match the format on power level, and the Infect players went, they had a pretty bad record, I think. Like, I don't, did Jujubeen go, what, like 2-1, and Burnous Taurus was in the 0-2 bracket?
Yeah, I think it was a 2-1 and 1-2, because notably, the 0-3 player in both formats was Tybalt of Red Sub, who did not have a good day at the office here. But yeah, I think a combined 3-3 record on the day, which inherently with a tournament of this size, it's going to be a small sample size, can't read too much into it, but I agree with your general assessment there, I think. So we should touch on the details of these Infect decks real quick. So this is 8 Hierarch Infect with notably no Glistener Elf as a 1-drop slot, and that's a change which does actually make some sense to me, because I think that if you're going out of your way to play Phyrexian Crusader with all of the strain that puts on your mana and the fact that this is a 3-drop, which you kind of need the 8 Hierarchs, I think, to cast on time, like that's an important realization, then that is an acceptance that you are kind of swimming upstream in the face of the conventional removal. So yeah, if you are trying to be this turbo Infect deck with Glistener Elf and Blighted Agent, well then, yeah, you're going to run into a wall of the Evoke Elementals and Renin 6 and Unholy Heat and so on. And so if the idea is the decks leading on those cards can just not kill Phyrexian Crusader, it's because they're very, very good at killing a Glistener Elf, or at least like getting that invalidated on the ground. And so at that point, why are we leaning on this card instead of just taking this more resilient approach? So in that sense, it's kind of the equivalent of what the Gorius Vengeance deck is doing, where we're not trying to be this like really fast reanimator combo deck, we're trying to be this like slower combo control deck that's playing the game on its own pace. And you see the mix of like pump and protection spells reflects that as well. So 4 main deck Thoughtseize, we got some spell pierces, and then more spell pierces in the sideboard, some Veil of Summers and so on. But we don't have the sheer quantity of just +4/+4 one mana effects that, you know, the Infect deck that you played at a Pro Tour 10 years ago in these colors would have had to say for itself.
Yeah, there's just a ton of Rancors. And I do want to point out one other issue with the Glistener Elf thing. If you believe what they said and that they predicted everyone's deck except for Carl's, if you expect one of your opponents to have Memnite and one of them to have Rune Crab, I don't want to be attacking with a 1-1 effect.
That's fair enough. But yeah, I think that highlights the issue with this choice is that, okay, you correctly predicted the parts of the metagame that you could predict, and yet the results were still kind of a mixed bag, because fundamentally, even when this deck is the smart choice for a small field, there's just kind of a cap on its performance inherently, and I think they ran up against that cap.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about the other piece of this, which is that there were 0 Ragavans in this tournament.
Yeah, so no Murktide, no Scam, no Domain Zoo from last time, no just random like Breach. Ragavan Fury decks,
yeah,
no Breach, anything like that. So generic Ragavan was nowhere to be seen this weekend.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird because this feels like a fairly good metagame for Scam, and I don't entirely know why people didn't register it.
I think the creativity matchup is a big sticking point there. You can bias your Scam deck towards that, like more main deck Moon Effects, more discard, focus on Voidwalker instead of some of the other alternatives that people have gone towards recently. But fundamentally, even though I think the matchup should be better on paper, or should be better in practice than it is, like it looks good on paper, it just never seems to work out that way. And so I think that might have scared some people off. Also, I like, who would the potential scam players have been? So we have the male player locked in. We have Carl, who I guess was locked in on Eldrazi-tron effectively from day one. We had at least one creativity deck penciled in, and then effectively a second copy as well, or at least that's where the smart money was. And so it could only really be Bruno Oliva, who I think qualified via Vintage, which was also not his format. He just played the playoff on a whim and happened to do well. Or the team of Bernardo Torres and Juju Bean. But yeah, if those two land on something else, you're effectively only left with one or maybe two other people who could have picked something else, and there are a lot of somethings else for them to choose between. Don't really read too much into the constructed deck choices. They're interesting as this like game theory problem almost to analyze, but in terms of what do I take away from this for my upcoming Modern or Pioneer tournament, the answer is basically nothing. Just treat these as the weird oddities that they are.
Yeah, I think my big takeaway from looking at all this is just, like, play a good deck if I ever play one of these.
Sure. I mean, what would the good deck have been that you would have lent towards for this tournament, do you think?
Well, I don't want to talk about what I'm currently playing because I'm ignoring that advice completely. But I generally think that, like, if you're looking at this event and you don't know how many players you can expect to actually show up with real 4C, it's really hard to justify to me not playing Scam. Like, that deck is just very powerful and only starts losing when people really start bogging it down with other interaction. And I just, if the field is already starting off with X percent of people not going to be showing up with, like, Fury, Elesh, Norn, Solitude in their deck, I don't know. It's just, like, that's the problem. Like, what else is your problem?
You do realize that by sheepishly saying that you are not sticking to that advice and you're playing something that you could not possibly recommend to others, you've only made those others more curious about what you're up to.
I would recommend it. I just don't want to say it's like play the good deck advice. And I think we'll loop back around to that later after Pioneer.
Okay. So a little teaser of what's in store for the end of the show, maybe. But let's get into Pioneer then, unless you have anything more on the marks for now.
No, it is a very... It feels even weirder than some of the past mock snapshots that we have seen.
Definitely. The one predictable thing about the mocks, though, other than there being a copy of Mill, was Nathan Stoy was in the booth and predictably showed the world why he is maybe the best player in the world at the moment. Just brought a level of insight not just insight, but also being able to relay that in real time, which any commentator will tell you is much easier said than done. His first time in the booth and seemed like a natural at it, so yeah, no surprise on that front.
Yeah, the really good players tend to be really good at talking about the game, with a few notable exceptions, like, that's the default.
But that's almost fun as well, when the people who are really good cannot put that into coherent words and just end up with this kind of, like, weird savant quality to them.
Yeah, anytime someone talks about this, I just think about the time that Seth Manfield won a Grand Prix by building a deck out of his trade binder.
And presumably was not able to provide some kind of rationale for those choices?
This... I'd have to look up exactly how many Sorin, Grim Nemesis, and Obnixilus Reignited were in this deck, but yeah, that's where we're at.
Yeah, I think that during that, like, standard season, there were a lot of people who just copied Seth's exact 75, which, in the dark, is not necessarily a bad strategy, but they quickly realized that they are no Seth Manfield, and they maybe had no better explanation for some of those choices than Seth himself did.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I think this deck, like, three sets later also won a Pro Tour, and the person playing it was baffled at how they won or something like that.
Oh, I think it was... I think Lucas himself said it was a terrible choice for that Pro Tour, but scoreboard, I suppose.
Yeah. Anyways, moving along to Pioneer, where Obnixilus and Sorin are very clearly not playable.
Yeah, so they are Pioneer legal cards that you can put in your deck, but we would officially not endorse doing that. One deck that you might trick yourselves into putting those cards in is the Boogeyman of the format, maybe, in Rakdos Midrange. So this is a natural starting point, and I hope that my tone conveys my level of enthusiasm or confusion for the deck, because mid is the word for it, I think. Like, it's still the most popular deck in any Pioneer tournament. It's still putting up very good results week in, week out, at both, like, the paper RTQ level, the small events, the big events, and then also when you get to the weekly challenges and so on. And there have been no, like, real innovations recently. It's kind of the same deck that it has been for the past few months. Ginger is going to change his sideboard guide week in, week out, and then you have the debate about that approach versus, like, the Shota list from the Pro Tour with Mutavolt and Jarvis will yell at you if you don't play Four Shielded, and I will join him in yelling at you probably, but like beyond that it's pretty minor stuff. And yet, so like the deck is performing very well, and yet I'm not sure like what I want to get paired against if I choose to put this deck in my hands for a tournament.
Yeah, I think so. One of the big narratives, and we'll talk about this with other decks that are like coming up, is that it feels like people have finally started to figure out how to build decks that are like 60-40 against Rakdos as opposed to 40-60, and like that is a pretty big swing for the deck and the natural slipping point of all the mid-range decks, except for the part where people just still play all the decks that Rakdos is 60-40 against, so it just keeps showing up and winning. Like, you just look at these decks, it's like, yeah, well, people are playing blue-white control, and it's like, yes, you are going to beat the blue-white control players most of the time, and the blue-white control players are winning, and then they just lose to Rakdos, like, every time.
Is it still 60-40 against blue-white if the blue-white players have 80 cards in their deck?
I can only assume that makes it... I don't know if that makes it better or worse. I just... I don't have a real assumption there. I don't think it really changes anything. The blue-white decks, like... The problem isn't, like, drawing a Yorian or, like, the card quality being... Like, the blue-white deck is just full of cards that are approximately all the same. It just... None of them, like, when you're trying to line up Make Disappear and Dovin's Veto against Rakdos cards, it just doesn't happen right sometimes. And 80 or 60 cards does not smooth out the numbers there.
So I guess the argument that people would make is the question of what do you want to get paired against is kind of the wrong question. You just have a fundamentally sound and strong deck that is mostly unexploitable. And so if you just show up with that, then unless your opponent is doing something like very off-kilter, and that off-kilter thing happens to be specifically good against Rakdos, well, then you can like your odds regardless, and almost always you improve more in sideboarding than your opponent does. And so it's a kind of deck which gives you the feeling of agency, and I think does actually give you agency for the most part in both deck building and gameplay. But I think there is always the looming mid-range issue of you have these decks which are like 55% against the field at large, and then that can slowly creep down as the format adapts to a deck to the point where, well, actually overnight, well, not overnight, but it has become 45% against the field without you ever really noticing what the tipping point was. And so if you are a week or two behind the curve on that, then you can really get punished. So I would say if you go back to when we did our standard preview for that round of Arceus, the Grixis deck was the perfect example of this, where it seemed like at the start this was 35% of any given standard tournament and like 4 to 5 copies in the top 8, and this was a deck to beat and really the only deck to beat, and it seemed like this might be another one of these one deck standard formats, until by the end of that RC season Grixis was mostly unplayable and unplayed, and the people who chose to stay in that lane were just playing straight Rados instead, and those Rados lists in turn had made themselves very good against Grixis. And I think unless you are equally nimble in this case, then you risk being kind of left behind in the dust. That being said, the counterexample might be just the Rakdos deck in this current standard format, which we fully expect to get hit by multiple bans this time next week, where, like, yeah, in theory, there are a bunch of decks that go over the top of Rakdos and or try to go underneath Rakdos and can do their thing. And yet, because they are just fundamentally less consistent and solid than Rakdos is, well, Rakdos's mix of like disruption and aggression can just put them to the test, and often they fail the test more than they seem like they should on paper, and so yeah, they can sign the match slip complaining how they got unlucky and their Rakdos matchup is great, and yet when you look at the actual numbers, Rakdos is still putting up good numbers against that. So I'm not sure which camp Pioneer Rakdos is going to fall in for this RC season, but I'm not sure I'm going to be the one trying to find out.
Yeah, I think I'm still pretty solidly on, like, Rakdos is good, and we'll get to some of the recent developments that really push it in the direction of me wanting to play Rakdos, as opposed to, like, it feels like any shift towards the decks that actually are trying to beat Rakdos is immediately met with a bigger counter shift to decks beating them, and then, like, Rakdos somehow wins this whole thing, and it really feels like that is continuing to happen. And like, I guess we should talk about like the decks that do really claim they do that, like the five color decks, especially the Karuga Fires deck and stuff like that, that like, here is my pile of 2-for-1s and stuff, and Rakdos has to beat them all. And then like, I think that there's just enough percentage that you just steal the games back, and like other decks get to exploit that. Like, I guess there's a lot of other decks that are going to come up in the discussion, but like Blue-White Spirits, for example, beating up on these decks and then just like in turn also losing to Rakdos because that's what it does. Like, I feel like it's really hard to cycle out of that.
There is also the question of how much are these Rakdos decks actually trying to beat you? And so you go back to our episode on the structural like successes and failures of mid-range decks, and one way that they can be stretched too thin is where like you have these decks the complete opposite extremes of the format popping up and forcing them to deal with different problems at the same time. And arguably that was the story of this weekend, where on the one hand every single person on Twitter was ranting and raving about this Convoke deck, calling it the second coming of Hogak, and then on the other end of the spectrum entirely you have the finals of the NRG event is just a blue-white control mirror. And so the cards that you need against both of those decks, if you're trying to prepare for an upswing in either one, are totally different. There was effectively zero overlap, and then you still have the entire spectrum of decks in between there. And so, yeah, if Rakdos wants to beat fill-in-the-blank, it can do that. And yeah, if I might think that my combo deck or my control deck is good against Rakdos, if they're showing up with a bunch of Duresses and like multiple Lilianas, and then, you know, if I'm a graveyard deck, if they have enough graveyard hate, then I don't think I like my matchup anymore. But if they've replaced those with a bunch of like Meat Hook Massacres or whatever, because they have to deal with all the Convoke people who are capitalizing on that trend, well, now maybe they just don't have slots for me anymore, and I can feel a lot more confident in that.
Yeah, I think that's a little weird, and some of that is also resolved in like the looming threat of Lotus Field and if you can disrespect that deck or not.
Yeah, I think also the green matchup has been this this contentious issue for Rakdos over time, where once you get to the point of you have main deck Misery Shadows and like 3 to 4 Extinction Events in your sideboard, and that's your sweeper of choice, as opposed to like Rich Love Cert or maybe some of the other options that are going to work their way into that discussion now. At that point, yeah, I think it's close or maybe even Rakdos favored. If you don't have main deck Misery Shadow and you have to biased towards other sweeps instead, well, then you're leaving this glaring weakness in your mono-green matchup. So that's yet another pressure point that is on the table here, and I guess we can get into later how popular we think green is going to be for this round of RCs too. But you know Rakdos is going to be, I would say, the most popular deck, and so whether you are playing with it or playing against it, like, these are questions you have to consider either way.
Yeah, and also just part of the consideration is, like you said, it's a deck with agency, and that your opponent's choices are going to matter more than yours on every round that you play against it. Like, just yes, what they chose before the event started, and like, somewhat in-game, but really just like a little bit of predetermination.
So what would you choose with your Rakdos deck then? If you were playing Rakdos this weekend, are there specific main deck or sideboard card choices that you have strong opinions about?
I think that it's the kind of thing where, so you were like, well, yeah, Extinction Event isn't the greatest thing against the Boros deck. Well, it's still pretty good. And like, if it's good against green and good against the Boros deck, it just means that you get to play like 3 Extinction Events and 2 other sweepers and be fine with your life. That's kind of like my starting point there, and just being like pretty heavy on that. I think it is hard to predict what exactly is going to happen with Lotus Field, because the Boros deck is just like naturally the kind of thing that has always beat up on Lotus Field, in my opinion, which is just like a very fast aggressive deck is always the problem, because if they even show up with a hint of Damping Sphere, the matchup is atrocious, and even if they don't, it's close. But at the same time, like, the Lotus Field decks have been sort of integrating more sweepers in general and could continue pushing down that path and maybe push back against it. But, like, maybe you just have some amount of, like, the Lotus Field deck is not my concern, and from there you work out all the sideboard numbers.
Yeah, or maybe you say, look, the only graveyard deck that I need to respect is Greasefang, and I'm fine just ignoring that and taking my L there if I have to, and that frees up the 3 to 4 slots that were previously being used on Leyline of the Void or on License Hearse or something like that, and maybe targeting a different band of decks instead.
Yeah, or you could, like, you know, Rending Volley as your removal of choice for Greasefang is relatively reasonable at trading for the Boros deck's cards, as just, like, it doesn't necessarily kill all their stuff, but, like, you just get to trade one mana for something at some point. That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. So moving on from Rakdos then, I guess let's talk about Stock Green. So this is the other deck which has survived intact. People thought it was going to take a ban at some point, and then it effectively dropped off the map entirely, to the point where if you were joining the format at that stage, you would wonder, well, why were people even having those discussions in the first place? I think it now is having this resurgence on, in large part because of this bounty of cards that it got from the most recent set. And the big one there is, of course, Pelucanos. So this is in the debate about how do we use these three or maybe four, if you're feeling frisky, flex slots in the deck. Well, this now has answered most of that question, and now we're down to one or maybe two flex slots instead.
Yeah, the card's very good. Like, we talked about the coverage that it provides in a bunch of other matchups before, you know, the 4-5 against 4-4 Flying Angels, just being a big creature to slam against aggressive decks, being a threat that your opponent has to resolve in some way before it turns into a Wurmcoil Engine against mid-range decks. Like, just a good card. I think my bigger issue with green is that I am uncertain about the matchup against this Boros deck, and, like, there are a lot of decks in that field of, like, the Boros deck, but also, like, Azorius Spirits, where, like, the matchup even with Pelucanos is still a little sketchy, and, like, there's this debate of, like, it could be bad, and if people show up with the Boros deck, like, that beats Spirits, but, like, will people even adjust to that and not play Spirits enough? And, like, will any of this in the mix, like, will Rakdos get lost and Blue-White just get to play, in which case, like, my understanding of the blue-white matchup is that if you play mono-green at 100% skill, you will maybe win every match, but also potentially just draw because you run out of clock, and also, like, if you screw up at any point, you die.
Yeah, my experience against blue-white is that it's pretty rough a lot of the time, and I know that Bobby has some, like, incredibly cosmic-brained theory on how to play the matchup where he declares himself to be the control deck that's playing these 20 turn games where he's running blue eye out of win conditions by picking spots to, you know, resolve his Khan to, like, repeatedly stone brain away all the relevant cards and just never attacking with his board because it invalidates Wandering Emperor. And like, if that works for you and your name is exactly Bobby Fortinelli, great. I have not seen anyone else adopt and then succeed with that approach, so this might be like a don't try this at home kind of situation. And if you're not trying that at home, I'm not sure what your approach to the matchup is instead, because again, in my experience, it has not been good. And if they want to target you, they are much better at doing that than you are at clawing equity back in the reverse. So yeah, if they have a bunch of change equations in their 75, that's going to be tough, or 95 potentially, that's going to be rough for you. The more kind of magic they have, if they have the right, like, sideboard pivots, then that can be an issue for you as well, where you can't play these long games if the opponent is applying pressure and backing it up with counters at the same time. And that's why the Spirits matchup is so impossible. And that one does get better with Pelucanos, but it becomes playable as opposed to just absolutely heinous the way that it was previously. There also is a concern, I think, that adding Pelucanos, like, it improves you across the board, and it improves some of the bad matchups, but it actually arguably leaves you weaker elsewhere. So, like, against Rakdos, for example, if you think about what those flex slots were being used on previously, is stuff like, you know, Lovestruck Beast, Sky Sovereign, a main deck Cityscape Leveler, which I think Bobby and Evil Twin Ari Zax still have, but a lot of these previous candidates for those slots were actually better in the Rakdos matchup than Pelucanos is, which is just, like, another thing which is good, but is pretty likely to die and also get swept up by Extinction Event post-board and so on. And at that point, like, if you are consciously losing some ground against Rakdos, you really have to be buying a lot back elsewhere for that trade-off to be worth it. And I think it is, but that is a sacrifice that is being worth being aware of.
Yeah, you know, even if Pelucanos is a functional card, it's not a Skyboat.
Yeah, so I think I would still want maybe a main deck Skyboat, which is also good against decks like Spirits and Mono White Humans, which is another issue you have to worry about, and some of these other matchups, but also is one of your best cards still against Rakdos. And I think there's also this issue of, like, I started out testing for Pelucanos just to get reps in with the new card and to see how often this issue of, you know, it costing triple green and getting stuck without triple green would come up, and also how much the flip my Pelucanos and then play a second one and have it die, like, is that an angle that's realistic to chase? And my verdict was, you do get stuck with at least one, if not several, uncastable triple green cards often enough that, like, I don't think you can play for, even if the metagame's in a spot where the card Pelucanos is very good, just because, like, you just run into that issue too often.
Are you referring to, like, the duplicate legend, or just, like, hands where your opponent kills Llanowar Elves and your lands are Nykthos Forest Forest.
Yeah, just the hands which are like Green Source Elf Nykthos, which have enough else going on that you have to keep, and if you hit the forest and your elf lives, then it's great, but then if your elf dies and or you don't hit the forest, then you're kind of in a tough spot. Like, those hands are a decent part of your range, and you need those to be functional, and they maybe are if it's, okay, one Orgrowth Troll that's kind of out of commission for the time being. If you have two cards, which are effectively mulligans in your hand, especially if you've taken an actual mulligan already, then that's not really acceptable.
Yeah, I agree that there's a lot of fail rate being added there. I really, really want to emphasize the suggestion of, like, playing Skyboat now just as, like, a cleanup crew against the aggressive decks on top of Blue Chronos. That might be a really good use of that last flex slot.
Yeah, there was some debate over Oath of Nissa versus the flashy new thing in Invasion of Ixalan. I've actually been pretty impressed by Invasion personally, but I do seem to be alone in my corner on that one. So the stock lists all have Oath of Nissa, and that's fine to me too. I don't think that choice really matters too much in the end.
I think Bobby had a Invasion in a flex slot recently, but I forget the exact list.
Yeah, I will note, I have also really liked having the 22nd land in green, because in the games where your elf dies, then you really need to be able to make your land drops naturally and not miss a beat. And that's even more true now with the additional triple green cards, where like you need to maximize your odds of just having the second, if not the third, green source. And so, like, if the choice is 21 lands and 4 Pelucanos or 22 lands and 3, I'm going to go with the latter, because my Pelucanoses will just be easier to cast, and I'm not sure I even want to draw multiples of them in the first place, so that seems like a fair compromise to me.
Yeah, I agree on the bonus land. Again, it's mitigating the fail case that you were talking about of just green, 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 colorless green, green.
And then beyond that, so like the main deck is mostly locked in within a slot or two now, and then the sideboard has always been like 12 to 13 cards are there, and then maybe one or two are up in the air, and you could use some of those slots now. Like, I think it's plausible to play a second Ratchet Bomb effect if the Convoke deck really is here to stay. I would advise listening to Bobby's counsel on sideboarding with green, where like you do actually want to be sideboarding in some mixture of your cards that are good in the matchup some amount of the time. And I think I'm more open to actually boarding out Khan entirely against the aggressive decks than even Bobby is or anyone else. So there's some stuff you can do in that space, but by and large, like, main deck is mostly locked, sideboard is also mostly locked, so yeah, stock green, there it is.
Yeah, I have seen Bobby play with some like actual sideboards recently, but I don't know exactly the like right amount of artifacts to cut, and that's a fairly hard thing to say these days.
Mm-hmm. So where I'm at the moment is, I think stock green is my default for at least my first RC, but I'm not happy about it. So like, if I had to play the tournament tomorrow, I would play green with some amount of trepidation, and I would like to find something better. But if I don't, then I'll shove my chips in there and just hope to run it up.
That's interesting because of your like sort of, I'm unimpressed with Rakdos, and like you're unimpressed with green, but you prefer green. I don't quite know what to say about that.
And there may be some inconsistency in my own attitude towards this, which I will...
This is just like personal ramp vibes, isn't it?
Which I will choose to remain blissfully ignorant of as we move on to our next talking point here, which I think there's only one thing we can talk about. We can't delay it too long. Is this a Hogak situation?
I mean, I think the way I've seen to describe it is like, it's Hogak, but all the cards have to end up in your hand, so that's sketchy.
So I think the idea is Knight Errant of Eos is like a juiced up citrus supply or something where it draws you your Hogak, and then you, I don't know what's going on here exactly, but this is the Boros Convoke deck, which really took Pioneer and mostly Twitter by storm over the weekend. So Sodek, you know, modern and combo specialist, won the Pioneer Challenge with this deck, beating Amira in the finals, I believe. His tweet announcing that he won and posting his list and saying that this deck is broken got, I think, 700 likes and a bunch of retweets. Like, it really took off. And then Doomwake was posting incessantly about this deck. Just whoever your favorite Pioneer content creator is, they have released something about this deck, and probably in quite hyperbolic language. And then today, I know that Mana Traders has been out of basically all of the core components of the deck for some time. If you look on GoatBots, Reckless Bushwhacker has spiked by like 500% or something. Like the hype is real for this deck. As for whether the results are real in the long term, I am a little more skeptical about that. I'm not saying that it can't happen. I'm not saying that this can't be like a new tier one strategy that is bursting on the scene. What I am saying is that the deck Hogak, after already having something banned out from underneath it, at a Pro Tour where, and a Pro Tour, not just like some random RCQ, at a Pro Tour where Leyline of the Void was the most popular card in the entire building, was still putting up banworthy numbers and had to be banned again. Like, that deck was just truly a scourge on Modern. And this deck, like, are people even caring about its existence yet? Like, can we at least wait until some of these cards actually start showing up in Cyborgs before we pronounce that the sky is falling and that something has to be banned? And, oh, well, good job that Andrew Brown said there won't be bans until September because we're going to have to suffer through this for 3 months. Like, let's hold our horses a little bit. Let's all simmer down here.
Have you considered the fact that Hogak did not win a Pro Tour while Federated Loxodon has?
Well, if Venerated Loxodon won a Pro Tour, then surely the person who won a Pro Tour with it would have, you know, qualified for the World Championships and received all of the usual accolades and, you know, recognition within the system that usually would reward them with.
What do you mean? They have the Andrew Ellenbogen Mulligan named after him.
Oh, of course. Well, I mean, there's no better way to etch your name in history than that. Like, some people get, like, their face on a magic card, but that's really the better prize, in my view.
Yeah, I am with you in that this is a, like, we have seen this hype before with the Reckless Bushwhacker decks. They previously were a lot worse than this one. Like, the sticking power of the Convoke threats is a lot better than whatever the red deck was doing before. That just, like, if your opponent played a Watch Wolf, you were like, oh, well, that's my entire game plan. Good luck. So I think that this is, like, again, I keep citing this with Rakdos. It's like, you should just be able to beat this deck with Rakdos relatively easily. And it's just a matter of, like, will people care in time? And, like, I don't know, the best deck in the format, like, being able to so easily adjust to beat you is, seems like a problem to me.
So I think the draw to this deck contextually, is that it is really hard for Rakdos to keep up with this deck if it's just a pile of fatal pushes and one for one removal and, like, those cards just don't really function against this deck, and it's easy for this deck to go wide and do that quickly enough that you just go underneath Rakdos and can overwhelm them pretty quick. The question then becomes, if the Rakdos deck start caring, and there are lots of tools for them to care with if they want to, how does that matchup hold up in a three-game set? And that's where, like, that is going to be, I think, the first priority for a lot of people's focused Pioneer testing over the next week or two, is just figuring out exactly how those Cyborg games play out against cards like, so Hidetsugu Consumzal is one that I've seen mentioned, which also has some nice splash damage elsewhere against like Black Red Sacrifice and so on. You can play some of the cheaper sweepers like Ender Festivities, I think is a popular one for the mirror at this point. You can go a bit taller with stuff like Path of Peril or Languish. In general, there's this trade-off where if you want your sweeper to be more comprehensive, then it's also going to be more expensive. And so if it's too expensive or too hard to cast, then you might just die before you can cast it, or it might not do the job effectively, or they get you down low, you sweep the board, and then they have like one drop into Bushwhacker, and then you die anyway. So you need to pinpoint exactly how efficient and wide-ranging does that sweeper need to be. Because one issue is like the Convoke 5-drops are actually pretty hard to kill. So you can't fatal push those things. Most of your sweepers are not going to get them either. And then the cards that do get them don't get anything else in the deck with anything like the efficiency that you need. And so that is one thing the deck has going for it against sweepers, is like a lot of the time you get to keep something, whether it's the one big thing or a few small things, and those can continue applying pressure. There is a sense in which like the ideal sweeper for Rakdos against the Convoke deck is Languish, because it deals with like basically everything unconditionally, but Languish costs 4 mana, and I don't think it's acceptable for your sweeper to cost 4 mana unless everything else in the early turns is going according to plan. So that's maybe the Meat Hook Massacre, I think. So that also leaves the big stuff untouched, but then if you cast it for 1, that gets most things, but then like Thraben Inspector, Burning Tree Emissary can survive sometimes, so there's nothing that does it universally and efficiently, and so you have to decide which of those you want to focus on, I guess is the point.
I think that just whichever one you play, it's very important that it's one that lets your children survive. Like, if you end up in any sort of stable board state and they rebuild after, you need your sweeper to be able to just kind of mop up whatever their second wave is.
Yeah, which is why, like, Glistening Deluge actually kind of stood out to me as an option, because that does clear up everything, but also lets your Blood Tithe Harvester stick around, or your Graveyard Trespasser, or whatever it is, so you get to stabilize or start applying pressure yourself before they have too much time to rebuild. So I would keep a careful eye on the results from next weekend and see exactly what, like, Ginger and other Rakdos players choose to put in their sideboards with this matchup in mind. Although, if you ask Ginger, my experience is he will say, you know, insert decklist here is a good matchup regardless, so maybe he doesn't feel the need for any tailored cyborg cards.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you gotta cut your castle lock, Twains. I think that that's the start. Like, you probably gotta do that anyways, but you should probably cut them if you expect to play against this deck.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of those responses more broadly then. So Rakdos has access to a certain subset of effects. You know, blue-white control, like, is going to be leaning a lot harder on stuff like temporary lockdown over the next few weeks, I would imagine. More broadly, I think some of the focus has been on Ratchet Bomb / Fenugreek Silex, because this is a colorless effect that basically any deck has access to. So I know some of the Lotus Field players were like agonizing over, if this is a new big thing, well, this deck is just faster than us. Like, can we actually keep up with it? And my semi-joking response was, well, yeah, just play some Ratchet Bombs and you'll be fine. And I think that's going to be the, like, low-effort approach for basically any deck that wants to, is just play some Ratchet Bombs and then maybe I'll be fine?
Yeah, well, I think the Lotus Field deck also just, like, generally wanted Ratchet Bomb to some degree anyways, I think, right? Like, there's a fair amount of other hate that you can just Ratchet Bomb. Like, it's very reasonable to board in Ratchet Bomb against other decks and expect to, if they play Damping Sphere, kill that, but also just, like, interact with the threat in a different way.
Yeah, and then across the board, like, so are there particular cards which, maybe color considerations aside, like, if you have access to them, given the deck you're playing, you should consider them for this matchup, in your view?
I think Lockdown's the big one, and that... So, again, this is the whole, like, how does the second order of Rakdos impact things? Because the Lockdown decks are very divided between blue-white, which is a good matchup for Rakdos, and these five-color piles that everyone says are very good against Rakdos, even if I have seen Rakdos steal a lot of games against them.
So usually the Lockdown decks are things like Karuga Fires or these slower five color decks where, as a result of playing Lockdown, you can't play some of the other cheap cards like Chain to the Rocks, right? Because the anti-synergy between those two cards is just too much to bear. And so you end up in the spot where, yeah, your Lockdowns are going to be great against Convoke, but the rest of your deck, you've made it so clunky and so slow that the other 56 cards just aren't fast enough to keep up. And so I don't know where that lands you in the end. Like, is just having access to four Lockdown enough to salvage the matchup? Probably not, and maybe you have to claw some of that back in sideboarding through other means, like other three mana sweepers, but I would... Maybe you have to suck it up and just play both of those cards together anyway? I don't know.
Yeah, I think you might just have to do... Well, I mean, the Karuga deck solves that very easily, but, like, I think that, like, the enchantments, like, the, you know... Incarnation decks, probably leaning towards Lockdown could potentially, like, you can skew your tutorable creature base to be intended to, like, block down random creatures so that they, like, really need to overextend and then lose. I think there's a lot of ways to make that deck work in this existing metagame, even though I probably shouldn't be saying this to you because it's just going to ruin a tournament.
Yeah, thank you. Well, on that note, there was also the Karuga Incarnation deck that popped up briefly, where I think the draw to that is you have access to both Fires and Incarnation more consistently. You slim down your toolbox as a result, and because you're a Karuga deck, you don't have the, you know, instead of having a bunch of twos you're hoping to pot into threes, you have a bunch of fours you're hoping to pot into fives, and that naturally, like, bloats your curve even further. But there's something to that approach, maybe. And that is a deck which is very happy to just run a ton of temporary lockdowns and call it a day.
Yeah, I am also somewhat interested. So Chrome Host Sea Shark has been popping up in the main decks of the, like, true five-color decks with Bring Delight. And I'm wondering if that is a card that can sort of tie the room together in these enchantments decks. Especially in this context where, like, it is provide, like, you play it, it provides an immediate blocker, and then it starts really spiraling over the next few turns in a way that other things won't. Like, I still hate the five color decks, but I think that Seed Shark is probably underplayed in the format right now.
Maybe. I think Seed Shark, when it's a fish out of water, is not that impressive. It needs the right backing for it. But I was blown away by that card in the blue-white control deck with Yorion that Dan Reiser won the energy event in Minneapolis with, where I saw those in the sideboard as the only new cards. He basically said he took Greg Orange's deck list and cards, and the only changes was just adding some Sea Sharks in the sideboard. And it seemed like they made the sideboard mapping much easier because they came in against literally everything. And also, they seem to be good against literally everything because against aggro, 2-4 is really big, and it's cheap enough to like gum up the board itself, and then all of your spells have this additional kicker, if you like. And then against a deck which you want to play this fish game where you're playing your threat and backing it up with counter spells, well, it's cheap enough that it does that. And then sometimes you have the combo of like Sea Shark plus Leyland Binding, Sea Shark plus other stuff. It just looked phenomenal there, to the point where part of me wants to just play that deck with four sideboard Sea Sharks and then have the rest of my sideboarding flow out from that.
I mean, you're just describing what I experienced with Starnheim Unleashed a few months ago, except for this one blocks. I also really like the fact that you can board in Seed Shark against these aggressive decks, and then when you Supreme Verdict, you just have cast Sunfall. Like, you just have a 4-4 anyway.
Yes. Yeah, that's, like, the fact that that control deck gets to play 4 Lockdown and then 3-4 Supreme Verdict, and you get to board into this pivot threat that actually works well with both of those cards, like, oh, that is just phenomenal as well to me.
Hold up. How does it work well with Temporary Lockdown?
Well, you play Lockdown, and then, okay, you exile your own incubator token. You exile all of their shit, and now you still have a Sea Shark
ready to like, deal with the second wave. The fact that your Sea Shark just survives is good enough. Okay, I just wanted to point out the very awkward situation of you make a 3-3 token, and then it disappears forever.
Sure, but I mean, you can... I think that's a fine trade-off to make.
Yeah, it's totally fair. Like, these kind of early threats are always, you know... It's the modern-day transformational sideboard of, like, the transformation is you just put a card in your deck and then play a normal game.
Yeah, so going back to the Ho'gath comparison, one point where I think it actually is illustrative is there was this sense of, well, I'll just play my ley lines, I'll play my other graveyard hate, how bad can my Ho'gath matchup really be at that point? And the answer in many cases was still pretty damn bad, because they were going to board in their answers to your hate, and then unless your strategy fundamentally was sound against Ho'gath to begin with, there was a limit to how much you could afford to play graveyard hate, and how much that graveyard hate would actually buy you in the matchup. Likewise, we can discuss all of these quite narrow tools that happen to be good against a Convoke deck, but you ideally want to be on a strategy that naturally doesn't have to do too much work to make that matchup good. What do you think its matchup spread looks like before questions of cyborg cards come into play?
Probably quite good. Like, the sweepers are just in the sideboards in this format, or they aren't around. And it, like, this deck did pretty decent at the NRG this weekend, but so did Mono White Humans, and that's another deck that has a similar issue of, like, if your opponent just shows up with sweepers, that's bad. Like, the fact that both of those decks were winning a lot means that people just don't have those in a good spot at all to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my impression from the green side, small sample size so far, is there have been a lot of decks in Pioneer which just vomit a lot of power onto the board quickly, but in a mostly non-interactive way, and those decks generally have not had a lot of staying power, and also have not really held up against green, with the exception of the Auras deck, is really the only counter example. But you could, like, I've seen a lot of people hyping up, like, Scales. It's mostly one guy, actually, but a lot of hype around Scales on Twitter this week. And yeah, that deck can put up some amazing screenshots of, I did my thing, I clicked my three pieces together and just completely blew out my opponent. But then, as with this Convoke deck, you're not seeing the screenshots where they don't do that. So, yeah, I saw the tweet of 4 Ornithopters, one of them had different art, Adam, not sure what's going on there, into Lockdown on turn 1. Great. Not seeing screenshots of where you mold to 5 and you play like a Thraven Inspector and a Resolute Reinforcements and then don't do anything else and you die, which also is a big part of what happens, but, like, that's not getting the dopamine rush of Twitter likes, right? Similarly, a lot of these decks just... Like, green will just overpower you and outrace you if it's left to its own devices, and you kind of have to leave them to their own devices because trying to interact with them takes you off curve too much yourself to the point where it's not productive anymore. So like there's a canister list that has Forge Devil, so this 1-drop 1/1 which when it ETBs you shoot a creature for one and deal one to an opponent. That card might be enough to swing the mono green matchup by itself, but I think a lot of these lists, like on the draw, you're still going to be unfavored against mono green. I don't think you can do much about that.
Really, I would have thought that the like locks it on half of the deck was enough to push you over the edge there and just like actually produce enough quick power in a lot of games that it just doesn't matter. Like that and like Knight, it feels like the stickier nature of these threats are makes it easier to kind of go over the top.
Well, the problem there is 4/4 is just not a good stat line against mono green, and even less so now with Polukranos. But the fact that what is meant to be your big creature just still doesn't attack cleanly into Old Growth Troll or Polukranos or Cavalier of Thorns once the game gets to that point, and then that is still a prohibitive blocker if you're going wide, where it's like it's the age-old question of, okay, I have four creatures in play, but they're not that big by themselves, and so unless I have a really good way to enhance them, I still don't have good attacks into like a single 4/4, because yeah, I'm dealing six and I'm dealing four, and then, well, I just don't have a board anymore, so I can't attack. They've grown their board in the meantime, and so I get them down to like six, but how am I actually dealing those final 6 points?
That is fair, and that is probably why there are magnetic chasms in the sideboard.
Yes, which is fine for what it is, but then you run into this issue of like, that is a card which is going to sit in your hand for a few turns, and if in the meantime your opponent isn't just going up the board, but they're also doing their thing with Khan, or they're shooting down your thing with Sky Sovereign, or God forbid they tutor for their Ratchet Bomb effect with Khan, well then, okay, what is the chasm doing for you at that stage?
Sure, yes. There are a lot of ways to not have creatures on the battlefield and then have a Magmatic Chasm in your hand and feel bad. It's probably more egregious in the Convoke deck, where every piece of cardboard that isn't a creature is like, it's just like getting stone rained.
Yes, and this is one issue with the deck's flexibility, is that you can't really pivot into anything else. Like your land count and your resource requirements don't allow for that. And so you're kind of doing more of the same thing. So against Rakdos, a lot of these lists are bringing in cards like Wedding Announcement. And Wedding Announcement is a great card against Rakdos, but how much is it really changing in a deck where you're already just trying to go wide and where getting to 3 mana is actually not trivial a lot of the time? It's like you're boarding in this card which just does more of the same, and so if they're now reacting to what you were doing in the first place, well, you're just kind of playing directly into their hands.
I mean, it's not the, like, I don't know, we're describing a plan that often fails in Limited, so yeah.
Yes, I would put my money where my mouth is and say that I do not expect this deck to A, be that popular, or B, that successful, or B, be that successful at the RCs in 2 weeks, and I will happily bet on that with anyone who is so inclined. Until then, do we have anything else on Convoke, or should we move on to other things?
Yeah, it definitely is the kind of thing where I think there's a specific window, and it's closing fast. And maybe we should move on to like some of the other decks that are getting flashy, like the various new approaches to creativity.
Yeah, there are at least four different approaches to creativity, which I've seen discussed and which I think all have their own merits. So you can do the Xenagos and Worldspine Worm thing that Rejuke won the Pro Tour with. You can do the double worm approach that I was keen on a few months ago. Atraxa creativity has picked out some steam recently. And then also the new craze where Gearhulk is concerned is the, or where creativity is concerned, not to bury the lead, is the Gearhulk deck, which aims to play more of a fair game, and so yeah, the thing you're creativating into is less impressive on its own merits, but you can just cast that thing and play a game that builds towards casting that thing and not be solely reliant on doing the one namesake thing that your deck is known for.
Yeah, I mean, Magma Opus also just like looks very impressive against this new spread of decks, as opposed to just like having to set up the slower creativity for two and giving your aggro opponent an extra turn to just kill you.
Yeah, so that is, it does have that going for it too. I do also think that one issue with all of the other creativity decks effectively is being overly reliant on resolving creativity does place a cap on how good your Rakdos matchup can actually be, because, like, yeah, they're just, if they have the draws which are Thoughtseize plus pressure, well, sometimes they just Thoughtseize your one copy of creativity, and if that is the only relevant thing your deck is building towards, it's not actually that easy to rebuild that, given the card filtering options in Pioneer. And then if that is being backed up with like Liliana the Veil is a card that is really troublesome for the various creativity decks of any stripe, I would say, but particularly the more combo focused ones, where if the idea is I'll get to turn four, I'll cast my big score, and then I'll untap, and then I'll cast my creativity, you might just not have any cards left by then. Like, if Liliana has been uncontested for a few turns. So I think that, again, and this is maybe answering my own question about Rakdos, if it decides to care about you, it's probably going to be easier said than done, but I think the Gearhulk deck structurally just are much better suited to fighting that fight on their own terms.
Yeah, they're probably the most broadly successful deck in my mind when it comes to things that have adapted to actually be 55% or better against Rakdos.
I do have a bone to pick with these Gearhulk decks, though. Why the hell are we playing Divide by Zero again?
I have heard rumors that it's good. I don't really know, though.
Yeah, so I can see kind of why you would want the card. I think it's maybe even better in post-Cyborg games because, like, if they have stuff which you care about in terms of Unlicensed Hearse, Leyline of the Void, stuff like that, which is interfering with Gearhulk, well, you bounce that and then you can maybe hit it again with the Gearhulk on the way back down. But just as a card, I think it is pretty underwhelming on rate, and it's the kind of thing which is, as Remand effects tend to be, like, good when you're ahead, bad when you're behind, and I think the creativity deck is already somewhat clunky and has that issue, and if anything, like, one thing the deck does have going for it is, because you are a Fiery Impulse deck, you can keep up with the turn one elf starts or the fast starts from other decks on the draw sometimes, and Divide by Zero, not a great card if you are behind on the draw. I'm also more confused about how that now spilled over into all of the other creativity decks have picked up Divide by Zero too, even the ones that aren't hoping to do the 1-2 thing with Gearhulk. Like, the Atraxa decks just have some Divide by Zeros in them now, and that is even more baffling to me.
Well, I think that there's two things to discuss here. One is that, Divide is the, like, you no longer have to choose which interactive spell you want against which combo deck, because Divide is pretty good against all of them. Like, in a mirror, Divide is going to be fine. Against Greasefang, Divide is going to be fine. Against, you know, Mono Green, Divide is going to be pretty darn good. Against Lotus Field, it's going to be fine. And the, I guess it's a discard outlet for your Magma Opus if you can't spend the mana to do that.
Yeah, I think an issue I have with it is Divide, you can't really buy out an effective use of your mana with it if they don't play into it. So, yeah, if they hold back their 4-drop sorcery that's going to take up their entire turn and you can't divide that, it's often hard to then use the Divide on that same turn to do something else. I think you just end up wasting your mana a lot of the time. I also think the quite awkward wording, like the non-token wording effectively, where you have to return a spell or permanent with mana value 1 or greater, is actually relevant text against stuff like creativity sometimes, where you have to, in the mirror or the pseudo mirror, you have to fight over the creativity itself and not, like, fizzle it entirely by just hitting the thing that they want to target, and so they can just present the same threat again next turn. I also don't like how, like, in a context where we've mentioned there are all of these different strategies popping up on different ends of the spectrum where the tools against one are not as effective against the other, then your sideboard slots are a little more taxed now, and so spending 3 of those on the obligatory lessons that you need to make Divide by Zero a flexible card, like, every part of that just doesn't really add up for me. It doesn't add up to anything meaningful.
Yeah, the obligatory lessons are pretty bad. Like, I am not especially impressed with most of these cards. I guess Teachings of the Archaics is sort of a solution to the problem of Divide against Rakdos, but yeah, I'm not really happy with any of the rest.
I mean, how often do they actually have more cards in hand than you do? Like, if they're Thorsteasing you, that's a one-for-one trade. Their deck is more efficient than yours. They can unload their hand more easily. If they're playing Liliana, right, or they have the first Fable, they're just committing cards to the board and then committing cards out of their hand. Like, are you even meeting that condition any amount of the time?
I think that some of the goal is that Divide by Zero is creating that card in hand imbalance, but it's super sketchy.
I like what the Gearhulk deck is doing conceptually, but I think a lot of the bad cards that people are adding to pair with their Gearhulks, I'm not about that. I want to keep it lean, keep it efficient, keep it flexible, and then I think the Gearhulks will kind of take care of themselves after that.
That's reasonable. I guess one more argument for Divide by Zero is, what else are you flashing back with Gearhulk that isn't Magma Opus that's actually impactful? Like, I think that the giant Mana War mode of Gearhulk is relatively powerful compared to, like, the Volcanic Spite mode.
Well, I think giant Flametongue Carvu often is better than giant Mana War, and maybe you have to add some like impulses or whatever. So it's a
Is it really an Raven FTK? Familiar? I what are you killing with Volcanic Spite that is actually scary?
I mean, stuff like Grease Fang or stuff from Spirits, but like resolving your Gilhook against Spirits is not easy either. That is one issue, I think, is that the damage-based removal in red does drop off pretty hard, pretty fast. I know some of the Gilhook lists have had Fading Hope, where sometimes you turn it into actual Mana War, but then Fading Hope is cheap enough that you can save your own Gilhook to reuse it later on. So I kind of like that angle. I do think that is a problem with the deck. I would rather address it by having maybe some more high-powered draw spells like Dig Through Time, Behold the Multiverse, even Big Score still in this deck, something like that. Or maybe some like more bespoke removal where maybe it's not good all the time, but when it's good, it's really good. And I think this is actually a virtue that the Gearhulk build has in post-Cyborg games, is where like if you make it so your good Cyborg cards are mostly instants, well, now your Gearhulk is just gangbusters all the time when it comes down.
Yeah, the Fading Hope thing is certainly an upgrade to a lot of this stuff to me, especially when, like, you know, I look at the mono green deck. Like, what are you actually targeting with your removal? Like, it's good exactly, I don't know. Are you on the play against Llanowar Elf every game for Volcanic Spite? Otherwise, why is it in your deck? And, like, there's a lot of other spots where that feels kind of, I don't know, like, it's doing the same thing where, like, what are you actually trying to cover?
Yeah, so in terms of other creativity variants, I know that the team that Mox winner, Marco Vassallo, True Hero, is part of, has been pushing the Attractor list recently. I liked my own take on the Attractor list at first. I think that where theirs runs into problems is, like, to me, when you're choosing a creativity list, if you want to frame it that way, you can either do the combo thing where if you get to do your thing, then you are going to win the vast majority of the time. Or you do the Gearhulk thing, where you do have the embarrassing case of like, yeah, I resolved my creativity, I resolved my Gearhulk, and then they just dealt with the Gearhulk and I lost. But in return, you get a much more normalized and functional deck. I think their take on the Attractor approach kind of falls in this gap in between, where they can't cast their Attractor, but they also don't have ways to, like, you know, Big Sword into Attractor or... One reason I was drawn to Attractor was getting to play Transmogrify as redundancy on my creativity effect and being able to do that turn 4 against other linear decks more often, and they don't have that either. So you end up still being overly reliant on resolving the card creativity in order to win the game, but then the payoff for Attractor in these decks isn't that reliable because the constraint that creativity places on you means you can't play artifacts and you can't play other creatures, so those types are off limits. So you get like a land and a Fable maybe and an instant and then maybe like another copy of creativity, but where's that really getting you? And then sometimes you do that and then your Attractor gets ossification or something and then you just die anyway. So I'm not really sure what you're hoping to optimize for by choosing Attractor, where all of the other approaches at least make some amount of sense to me there.
What do you feel about a list? So there's a list by Binu from one of the challenges recently that features one Attractor and three Gearhulks. What do you feel about a split like that that allows you to both stretch to a larger creativity but also preserve some of the like upfront power of just flipping an Attractor whatever percentage of the time?
I could be convinced to do that, actually, especially if I have maybe one to two Big Sword in my deck so that I maybe can cast Attractor some amount of the time, and I can also set up the line of I'll Big Score into creativity for two, and then if I hit a Gearhulk, I can flashback the Big Score and keep going, or I hit the Attractor and now I have an Attractor in play. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this and there's like, okay, so how are we going to get all the four colors of mana? I mean, this Murex is going to make it for a turn. Yeah, it's pretty sketchy.
Yeah, Murex is, I don't know. I've seen a lot of sketchy Murexes in the past few months where it's been legal, but I think this is maybe one of the shells where you can justify it, although I've still been drawn to just the Mutavaults in these shells, where like the turn 5 play of Mutavault, Animator, and then Creativity allows you to kind of fire off out of nowhere in spots where, like, one of the things holding Creativity back is it's a 4 mana sorcery speed investment that also prior to that requires you to find a window to, you know, spend some amount of your turn getting a target forward in play. And if you can do that for 1 mana and it almost doesn't matter when you commit that mana, well, that's a really nice way to make that more efficient.
Yeah, I kind of want to argue for the Murex of just like, I want to cast my 1 mana spells on turn 1 and that card does that and then I can figure out the rest from there.
There is that, and also with Blue Eye Control maybe getting a little bit more popular, like Mirex as Castle Ardenvale looks pretty appealing too.
Yes, it's a very weird... I don't know, I feel like the Blue Eye Tax, especially after sideboarding, like, game one, I don't think Mirex is going to save you in a lot of spots, but like, after sideboarding, it feels like it's just going to run into their Sea Sharks.
Yes, but that's going to be an issue regardless of what your plan is, so I wouldn't lean on Mirex as my entire plan, but just having it there in the deck, especially in game one, I think does go a long way.
That's fair. Like, it could, I think, I just don't want to overstate the percentages there. I just like the fact that my pseudo Mutavault makes mana on turn one.
Yes, but my testing schedule at this point has a creativity day where I'm just going to go through these different approaches and try and actually understand the relevant pros and cons for myself and figure out which one of these I want to preserve as a candidate, and then that one can like advance to the next round and maybe win the playoff there. But for now, let's go on to a deck which I've mentioned as what should have been one of the stories of the weekend but got edged out by all of this Convoke hype, and that's Blue Eye Control. So the finals of the NRG in Minneapolis was a blue-white mirror won by world champion of various non-magic card games, Dan Weiser, on Greg Orange's Blue-White Yorion list against Midwest grinder Sean Gallagher on just 60-card blue-white control. So on any other weekend, this might be the talk of the town, but Convoke kind of stole his thunder. I do also think, though, this is not just the other end of the spectrum in terms of hyper-aggressive linear deck versus pure control, but also... this deck does not allow for Twitter screenshot equity, if you like, where like, okay, I can post me having 9 power in play on turn one. What's the equivalent here? They had 3 creatures in play and I cast Supreme Verdict and then I resolved to Ferry next turn. Like, that doesn't quite get the chemicals going in the same way.
Yeah, it's tough. You really got to play a lot of matches to come up with a screenshot worthy event. I think Rewind may be a start towards that. Rewind making it into a deck is just shocking to me. But we've talked about this. The Rakdos matchup for Azorius is horrendous, but I think it's great against everything else. So if you think you can dodge that exact matchup, then it's pretty good. The Spirits matchup also, I am somewhat skeptical on. It feels like there are a lot of games where you're like, yeah, I did all the things in one, but like for every one of those, there's like at least one where everything falls apart and you die.
Yeah, I will say that is a matchup where Sea Shark goes a long way. Just 2/4 flyer, what up? And it's cheap enough that you can get it down and sneak it under their interaction. And then it buys you a lot of time just by being a 2/4 flyer to kind of get the other parts of the house in order. So I assumed, or I was told, the Rewinds were a Greg Orange special. And then I went back to look at his list from the Pro Tour, PT Phyrexia, and I saw Makahito Mahara's blue-white list that also had Rewind. So I don't know where this idea actually came from. I certainly understand the appeal, but I don't know if there was some source prior to that where all of this madness began. But in any case, I think blue-white kind of goes under-discussed for how relatively successful it is. So it didn't have any like hallmark finish at the PT. No one broke through to the top 8, but had quite a few players putting up decent results with it there. And then on Magic Online, you see some of these control mains. So Claudio, who it gets pigeonholed as a Niv main, but has been tearing it up with blue-white recently. He's been doing well. Some of the other control players have been doing well. And I think there's maybe this weird, unique problem where there are a lot of people at like the LGS level who... they're control one tricks, right? You can expect them to show up with a control deck, and they don't build or play it that well. And so that's kind of tarnishing the reputation of the archetype. But then you also have a few people who are like legitimate blue eye control mains, and those people are a force to be reckoned with in any tournament that they enter. And so I don't know if I have time to become one of the second group instead of the first group in the next 2 weeks, but it might be worth giving it a try. I don't know.
I think it is easier than... I think the real problem is that just so many people play Rakdos on Magic Online that you can't get away with it. I think the problem is not skill. The deck is like, on the scale of control decks, you are relatively aggressive and proactive, and like, there's a lot less of like, oh, I need everything to line up. It's just like, no. This Teferi's just gotta get on the battlefield and I gotta untap, and then everything else from there is a wash. Like, there's a very clear endgame you're playing towards. It's not like total card exhaustion. The problem is that just doesn't happen against Rakdos.
Yeah, I think trying to be reactive is a dead end against them. I wonder if it's possible to be a little more proactive, though. So you saw some of the Kahira lists from Magic Online, where you had Kahira as your companion and also a sideboard of like Brimaz and four Regal Caracal. And that was your transformation against a lot of decks, but specifically against Rakdos, where you were almost becoming a midrange deck, where, yeah, you would trade off your answers with their threats and vice versa, and your threats would leave some stuff behind or would be tough to deal with. And then you also had like Teferi and Memory Deluge as these cards which, if the game kind of ground down to a stalemate, well, these would just break those wide open and be impossible to compete with in any kind of longer game.
I think you're like describing this sort of mid-range plan and like long. I think the problem is that the Rakdos deck is just so aggressive. That's been my issue. Is that like you don't lose to like getting ground down on cards and then dying with like nothing. It's just like, oh, the zero card point happens and then the game is over. Like you go to zero life.
Yeah, so you would have to find a way around that. I don't know what that would be exactly. Like if there's some good 2 or 3 mana card that can kind of like try and do that back to them or keep up in a different way, that is an issue though. I will note, Teferi, another card phenomenal with Chrome Host Echarch, where you pay 5, you get a 5/5 incubate token, you want to have 2 lands at the end of your turn, and now you just have this dormant 5/5 ready to wake up at a moment's notice.
I am very skeptical of like this is just like I have my threat and then I've resolved my other best threat and then it's really good. I'm gonna win the game even harder.
Well, no, because I think the fail case before was my other best threat also cost 5, and so I have to choose which one to play, and whichever one I play might not be enough to stabilize. And if I play the Teferi, well, it draws a card and it untaps 2 land, and then it just dies to what they have on board. Whereas if your pivot threat costs 3 mana, well, that's like, that can slot into the early game, and then in the process make everything else you play in the mid to late game just that much better.
Yeah, I mean, the real synergy is that it costs 3 instead of... Yes. Yeah, that's it.
But it's very high impact, potentially, for a card that costs 3.
Yeah, I think we're just saying again and again that Seed Shark is just awesome, and it's, like, a legit reason to start playing Azorius. I don't know... Again, because it doesn't solve all the problems, but it might just make the margins so good against everything else that if you don't think the metagame is literally going to be 30% Rakdos, you're fine throwing away that percentage, especially at a multi-day event.
Yeah, there are some like other neat interactions with the Shark as well, so you can... and these will be familiar for fans of Shark Typhoon, of course. You can like overpay for much of Otherworldly Light, so you get just like you're killing your 1-drop, you're paying 5 mana, so you get the full value and, you know, the biggest... token that you can make there, or just there are things like that whenever you go looking for them. The fact that also Shark curves so nicely into both Deluge and Wandering Emperor as fours, where like, you kind of expect that four to just do something and then you will have to present a follow-up, and this 4/4 that you now have just on the board is a decent follow-up. So I would also note that I think I would still want like the sideboard actual Baneslayer Angels in this approach. I think those are just too important against specifically Greasefang, but also the aggro decks, like great against Convoke, of course, if you had the time, good against Spirits, Mono White, what have you. But then if you also have enough other creatures, those should be Boombringer Valkyries now, because the line of, you know, I have a Sea Shark, I have a Shark Typhoon token, Wandering Emperor token, and now I get the immediate lifelink swing on that, even if my actual Baneslayer is removed, like that is enough of an upgrade to like marginal Lyra synergies or something, then I think it's worth it.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think that also, like, it's not even just new stuff. It's just literally just like gaining 3 immediate life off a Wandering Emperor token is just more than enough.
Yeah, absolutely. So blue white, I think, will be a consideration for me. I agree with the general concern about its Rakdos matchup, but I think more broadly, it kind of exists on this pole of the format where it's never popular enough that you can really afford to hedge against control specifically. And for a lot of decks, it's not clear exactly how you're meant to do that. So if you are good against control, it's kind of accidental that you are, but you don't see people really showing up with dedicated anti-control cards other than weird stuff like, you know, Lotus Field maybe has a Sphinx of the Final Word in its sideboard or something like that.
Would you argue that showing up with Fable of the Mirror Breaker in your main deck is a dedicated anti-control card?
Well, no, because that's a dedicated like anti-everything card, because Fable is just kind of fucked up.
Okay, that's totally fair.
Yes. So let's get on from that to, I think Greasefang is a good place to go next, because this is another deck which I think probably should get more press than it does. And so there is a world where like Tangrams, who started off so well at PT Phyrexia and made some big leaps forward in how to build that deck, he ends up finishing in ninth place, tragically. But in the world where he at least makes a top eight and maybe goes further than that, then the deck would be more on the map there. His teammate Carl Sarup used it to qualify for the mocks where he showed up with Eldrazi Tron this time around. And I think that there is... I mean, it's weird to single out specific decks for this, because this is true of every deck to some extent. Like, the gap between Bobby and random green player is obviously ginormous. But I think Greasefang does have its own contingent of, you know, people playing outdated lists and playing them badly and not knowing when they can shove on Greasefang, when they should shove on Greasefang, how to play the fair games instead. Like, that has a big impact on how some of your matches will play out over the course of a long tournament. But a good build of Greasefang in good hands is terrifying, I think.
I've kind of had the reverse experience, where I have kind of felt like the fair games out of Greasefang have gotten edged out by improvements in the other decks. Like, I think that other decks have found ways to just play threats. Like, the Chromeho Seedshark development is on par with, like, the Shieldred developments, like a bunch of Shieldreds, and other things like that just showing up across the board that make Asika's Chariot just not a reliable way to win the game anymore. And then from there, you are just, like, forced down these roads of being these just a combo deck, and that's very disruptible.
Yeah, Shieldred actually is a card that I've seen in some Greasefang lists just as a backup threat that your Grizzly Salvages and Traverses and stuff can actually find, that can close out the fair games in a way that, as you mentioned, Asika's Chariot and friends are increasingly less able to do.
Yeah, at that point, I just, like, it's not a cohesive part of your plan, so I don't really know what you're accomplishing by being, like, this combo deck, but it's also a Shieldred deck. I mean, I've cast the card out of the sideboard, and it's good, but, like, you could just play Shieldred, like, in a deck. They allow you to do that.
Yeah, I think the idea is you're, like, linear combo deck game one against people who can't really contest that, and then pivot into weird Abzan Vehicles deck of a sort. But like, the fair Sky Sovereigns out of Greasefang have been surprisingly good in my experience, but you kind of need A, to be able to get there, and, like, it's a little more painful if you're leading on Mana Confluence hard and stuff like that. Like, it's the more you try and economize to be a good linear deck, the worse you become as a fair deck. So I'm not sure quite how you square that circle. The Lilianas as a sideboard pivot have really impressed as well, but then again, you need to have, like, this cohesive sideboard plan, which you can get for free by just going to Tangram's Twitter page, but I don't know if implementing that in practice requires, like, in-game understanding.
Yeah, I think the trickiest part you kind of pointed out is that, like, you are, like, the Greasefang half of the deck is very linear, and there isn't, you don't just have these threats that naturally bridge the gap on either side, with the exception of Chariot. It feels like there just aren't cards that are, like, if there was some powerful, like, if Shieldred was a self-mill enabler, that would make a lot more sense, where, like, just having a Shieldred on the battlefield for any amount of time makes it more threatening that you're going to combo them after the fact, and that just doesn't exist. And every card you put in your deck like that is just a card taken away from the combo part.
Mm-hmm. So what is your impression of Greasefang's Rakdos matchup? Because one of the big selling points I've heard from the Rat Pack that is all in on Greasefang is that it has the best natural Rakdos matchup of any deck that isn't, like, you know, some five color Fires deck or Yorion deck with heavily polarized matchups elsewhere.
It seems like they're, like, trying to argue that they're 52.5%. My impression of the matchup has not been especially favorable towards Greasefang. The Rakdos players, again, have a lot of agency in what cards they put in their deck, and, like, if their removal of choice is Power Word Kill over Dreadbore or whatever, then, like, the matchup gets a lot worse. I have also had this experience with, like, just they have a Shieldred and then I die. I mean, it's a very common experience in the format, but the actual, like, combo kill isn't, you get two blockers and that's good, but, like, if they just, like, fatal push one of the angels and tank nine to the face and then attack you with a Shieldred, what are you doing? Like, how are you getting out of this?
I do not have a great answer to that question, and thus I will move on to other things for now then. So we should check in on Lotus quickly. I continue to be surprised at how uninvested I am in Lotus as a deck, given just my usual proclivities in other formats. Like, it seems like I should be drawn to this, and something about it is holding me back. In terms of recent developments, there's some hype around the new Chandra Hope's Beacon as, like, the one obligatory win con which you want to have other uses when you draw it, and that's... I've heard mixed reviews that I think it's fine, but it's not a game changer by any means, but no real developments there otherwise.
Yeah, I like that kill con. Like, it's just a good castable card in a way that a... I guess Pyr is, like, reasonably okay to cast, but Chandra feels like it is just a more functional card than tapping all of your mana and losing half of your life and drawing your deck and, like, being effectively a 9-mana card. Like, you can just sort of, like, cast Chandra and it's fine. The kill, for those who haven't known about it, is that Chandra forks the first spell you cast after it every turn, and if you just find ways to get your Chandra into the graveyard and get it back out, it is a new Chandra every time. So once you have cast Omniscience, you actually can reach a point where you are, like, forking Balaged Recoveries to get back the Chandra that you just, like, you get back multiple other Balaged Recoveries and then, like, minus X the Chandra to 5 them and then get back the Chandra. And, like, there's loops there. There's similar loops with Odawara where you kind of don't fully ult Chandra and, like, loop an Odawara and a Balaged Recovery and end up paying a bit of mana under your Omniscience. So, like, I think some of the, like, acquisition kills were a little waffly at times. Maybe that's just, like, my inexperience with the combo kills, but, like, there is another piece needed after the fact, and not, like, it's not as absolute as these kills, which is nice. I don't know. Just the real upside should just be casting your 6-drop Planeswalker.
I think the bigger question is around how the deck is positioned at the moment, because for the last Pioneer RC cycle, and then again at the Pro Tour, there was this narrative of, at least for the RCs, of, well, the best decks are, like, Black Red and Green and Phoenix, and those are going to be the top three in some order, and then a bunch of other decks in this mid-tier, but of those top three, consensus was, like, Lotus is bad against Green, but it really demolishes Black Red and Phoenix, and then it also beats most of the decks in that second tier down as well, and so it was an amazing choice for that round of RCs. By the time of the Pro Tour, you know, Phoenix had dropped off, some other stuff had worked its way up into that, like, first or second tier, but most of that was still pretty good for Lotus, and the good Lotus players also cleaned up at the Pro Tour. And at each stage of that, we were saying, well, surely next week, this is when people finally respect Lotus and show up with their Damping Spheres and decks which otherwise can't really hope to beat it otherwise. And they just didn't do that, and the Lotus players showed up with their Lotus Fields and they did well. This time around, I don't know if things are naturally as favorable for Lotus, where, like, I've actually been impressed by how close the green matchup was from the Lotus side, but it feels like it's losing ground in a bunch of other places, and some of these new predators, like the Convoke deck, is kind of scary, right? Because Lotus Field is capped on how fast it can be, at least in any kind of consistent way, and if a deck like that shows up with a higher raw Gold Rush speed, there's not a ton you can do about it. So that's kind of scary. The Spirits list, I think, can be rough. Like, some of the creativity decks, but not all of them. And then, like, Grease Fang, I think, is pretty scary for Lotus too. So it seems like its positioning has got worse, even if the deck itself has continued to get a little bit more well-refined.
Yeah, that's about, like, if you talk about these Tier 2 decks, like, the majority of the Tier 2 decks right now are reasonable to good against Lotus, it feels like, without a ton of help. I mean, I don't know where you consider Rogues in the lower tier listing, but maybe it's just, like, an ultra, like, if you want to talk about, well, there's Bant Spirits, there's Blue-White Spirits, there's Mono Blue Spirits, then there's, like, Blue-Black, technically not Spirits, but it's basically Spirits. Like, that whole sector of the metagame is, like, naturally going to be pretty good against Lotus Field. Even if we, like, saw the reverse a long time ago, when the Underworld Breach versions of Lotus Field were able to compete, I think without just, like, the literal Underworld Breach combo kill, the matchup's a lot worse.
So, my take on Rogues is, this is another one of those decks which was very briefly hailed as the big new thing. It was broken. I'm sure some MTG Finance people made a killing speculating on Thieves God Enforcer in exactly the right window, but that deck has completely fallen off the map and is nowhere to be found now. Not saying Convoke is going to have a similar fate, but, like, once you've seen this same pattern happen enough times, you start to become just inherently skeptical until proven otherwise.
The deck at Nighthawk Scavenger. Like, that's just, you cannot do that. Like,
if to be fair, that, like, you're not forced to play that card the same way that, like, the usual Dunk on Blue Eye control is, oh, yeah, I guess you're gonna play Absorb, aren't you? You don't have to. Like, no one's forcing you to register these cards.
Yeah, but, like, that one should be so obvious. Like, Absorb is kind of like, I don't know, I'm gonna play some card in this ballpark, and, like, who really cares what the other text on it is? That card, like, you should not be playing a card in that ballpark to begin with. Like, what even possessed you to put that card on a deck list? Like, you should probably, like, as soon as you start writing Night Hawk, like, stop, take the deck list, shred it up, put it in the garbage, and just start over.
Noted. So, any final thoughts on Lotus quickly before we move on to some other fleeting choice?
I would not worry too much about Lotus if you, like, there's this idea of, like, oh, you should know Lotus, so you can pull, don't worry about it for this event. This is not the event where you have to put in your 20 hours of Lotus practice to see if, like, you might just, like, have the right vibes on Thursday, because you just won't. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, David Rude tweeted out this, I think was meant to be cryptic question of, if I have a deck which auto loses to a matchup that's like 4% of the field, but is pretty good against other stuff, how big of an issue is that over the course of a 2-day event? And my answer was, okay, we all know you're talking about exactly Lotus Field. And the answer is, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Which I think holds up across the board.
Yeah, I would not be too concerned about it either way.
Yeah, I think if you are on the other end of that choice and you're considering Lotus Field, if you're a Lotus Field main, I think it's a fine choice. You can just play your Lotus Fields and have fun doing that. If you are picking it up for the first time, I would probably hold off and go somewhere else. But, like, I think it's a perfectly fine choice and will remain so for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, if you trust yourself to build a very powerful sideboard for Lotus Field that lines up with exactly what you want the metagame to be and play it well, then more power to you.
Yeah. Quickly, let's touch on Rado Sacrifice. I have never really been interested in this deck. It's popped up here and there and done fine. Steven Dykeman, though, did pique my interest at the NLG this weekend with his list that had this, like, 1-2 twin style combo of Dreadhorde Butcher and Vol'dahren Thrillseeker, where, let's say you go, like, even just turn 3 Butcher, you attack for 1, becomes a 2-2, next turn you Thrillseeker back up onto it, it's a 4-4, it attacks and then becomes a 5-5, and you can then sacrifice it to deal 5, and then on its way out it deals 5, so with any help, and that help can just be you play your Butcher a turn earlier, you counter 20 there pretty quick, and so that buys you a lot of accuracy in matchups where the usual thing you're doing is, like, too fiddly and so otherwise. So I think he was 2-1 against Lotus Field on the weekend, and I seemed pretty happy with his, like, combo matchups in general, so that angle was enough to pique my interest, but the rest of it, I don't think is doing it for me.
Yeah, I don't think Dreadhood Butcher is a card that I would like in my deck against anything that isn't raw combo. That's my problem with it, is it's, like, I don't know, like, it's on the line of, like, main decking duress, is where I feel.
The other thing that caused people to take a second look here was the new Obnixilus, the 4-mana Obnixilus Captive Kingpin, where whenever the opponent loses exactly 1 life, you put a counter on it, you exile a card, you can play that until the end of your turn. And that, it looked very flashy and almost, like, suspiciously well-tailored for this deck, but the reviews I'm hearing is it's not really lived up to that hype yet.
Yeah, I mean, the core problem with this deck is that it's pretty good at beating up on other creature decks and pretty bad against basically every type of combo you could imagine. Like, mono green, no, you don't really want to play that matchup. The Lotus Field matchup, like, you're really struggling to come up with these racing plans. Like, creativity, like, I wouldn't, maybe the Gearhulk list you could pull some stuff out, but, like, it feels like a lot of the stuff that is currently surging in the metagame is stuff that you don't want to be playing Rakdos Sacrifice against, and that kind of puts you in a really bad position regardless of how good the new cards are or aren't.
Humans, another deck that got some hype off the back of one of these Aftermath cards in Copper Cove Vanguard. So my impression watching the NRG and commentating that, there was a lot of humans there doing pretty well, but I don't know. I think if you weren't interested in humans before, then this is not enough of a switch that should move the needle there for you. If you were interested there, your deck got like a decent but not fantastic upgrade, so I guess respond appropriately to that.
Yeah, I mean, the other respond appropriately would be like, everyone is going to be showing up with sweepers because of this other deck. Do you really want to be playing humans this weekend?
That is the other thing, too, is that from what I hear, the Convoke matchup itself is pretty rough for humans, and then you get a lot of splash damage from some of the anti-Convoke cards. So some of the smaller stuff, like Ratchet Bomb and their Facilities, I think is pretty marginal against humans, but if people are showing up with more, like, Meat Hook Massacres in their Rakdos deck or stuff like that, then it's going to be a tough time.
Yeah, it's just, like, the second best version of a thing that people are targeting. You don't want to touch that.
Yeah. So I guess we should touch on the four color or five color decks as a class. I've grouped these here as the Leyline Binding decks, for lack of a better term. So within that umbrella, you have the Incarnation deck, five color Bring to Light, the Fires Transmogrify deck, which has been picking up a little bit recently. And then I guess also Karuga Incarnation as well. Claudio won, I think, his 10th career challenge with five color Niv-Mizzet again. That one very much is a don't try this at home, I think, but the other ones maybe seem somewhat legitimate.
I still remain heavily skeptical of the five color deck in general. Just like, Courier's Briefcase is not a magic card that you should be putting in your deck, and like, anytime that is trying to tie the room together, it should probably tell you something about it. Also, the deck is just like generally threat light, and if your opponent just plays a game of like, I'm just gonna kill their big thing twice, and then they're just not going to have a card left in their deck to kill me with, that's kind of been an experience I've had, especially if like a 4/4 Omnath is not enough. Like, Omnath, like, as a threat is like, you stabilize and then like if they just kill your other stuff, you just don't have things to spend mana on, and you've just got like 4/4 cantrip that gains some life, and then you lose the game eventually.
Yeah, it is amazing how bad Omnath feels just in Pioneer a lot of the time. And I don't want to be, even in like the Karuga Fire deck that was kind of popular around the last RC cycle, Omnath felt like the weakest part of that deck, even though it was structurally a pretty good Omnath deck. So I'm not quite sure what that says, but the Brutalite deck doesn't play Courier's Briefcase anymore, you will be happy to hear, but none of the other options I've seen mooted for those slots really speak to me either. So I don't think there's a great way to fill that gap. And my experience has also been the same. It feels like weirdly threat light, because you need to have a bunch of lands and your Sylvan Character deck, and you need some other ramp in there as well. But then that leaves you with not that many cards that actually do anything. And because you're a Bring to Light toolbox deck, that half of the deck is kind of split down the middle in any given matchup between the cards that you do want to draw or do want to find and the cards that you don't. So yeah, sometimes one of your action spells against Rakdos is a Slaughter Games that isn't going to do anything. Or, yeah, sometimes against a control deck or a combo deck, one of the action draws you spell is a Sweeper or an Elish Norn or something that isn't going to do anything either. So the deck felt quite action-like in that regard, and it's a suspiciously bad Fable deck too, where this is one of the draws to the deck over something like Niptolite, is you just get to play Fable. But in this deck, Fable, it ties the room together in the same way it does in any deck Fable's in, but like, it's not, it's kind of doing that in a very minimal way, and you almost don't have to fear a transform Fable from this deck, because what the hell are they going to copy, right? Like, they can't copy Omnath, don't really care about copying Sylvan Character, so often you just let the Fable transform and just chill there for a few turns, because you know that you just literally don't have anything to worry about there.
Yeah, I mean, it's the classic history of Benalia problem, where it's like, I made a 2/2, and I made another 2/2, and I have 2/2s, and that's going to be lethal, right? Like, please? Like, we've agreed to this kind of magic. I am very, I don't know. I do not understand the reports of people winning with this deck, unfortunately. And that sort of brings me to, like, my assessment of the more extreme Leyline Binding decks are the ones that interest me the most.
Okay, so what are you thinking there?
Well, I think that, like, the Karuga deck obviously has a very clear flaw. Like, it's not going to beat anything that plays a Make Disappear in its entire life. Like, that's just not possible, whatever. But it's at least, like, attempting to do something that wins normal games of Magic in a very decisive way.
Yes, I think you can build, you beat some builds of creativity just by sitting on Leyline Binding some of the time. But yes, more broadly, I don't want to play this against any kind of reactive deck, and God forbid that deck is Spirits, because that sounds like a nightmare to me.
Yeah, all these decks are generally dicey against Spirits, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't touched much on Spirits yet. I think I maybe have an outsized respect for that deck because, A, I played it myself for a while, and B, I don't think any Pioneer deck that I've ever wanted to play has ever had a good matchup against Spirits. Like, I wish I could be one of these Phoenix gamers or whatever, or you know, live the Rakdos life. But given who I am, I don't think I'm ever going to be happy to face down a Mausoleum Wanderer.
Yeah, I think that... So I used to think that some of the problem with this deck was overstated. Where, like, yeah, the aggro matchups were bad, but you could play out of your mind and claw back that percentage. I do not think that is the case against the Convoke deck, especially. And I think that you're going to... If you play Spirits, be signed up for a very polarized experience basically every match you play, which may be something you want to sign up for, but, like, I think you need to go into it with no delusions of the opposite.
Yes, I would agree with that. I guess that covers... I mean, unless you had other thoughts that I cut off on the various Leyline Binding decks, you mentioned the Karuga deck, we can move on to some of the wild cards or decks that have kind of vanished but might be poised to come back.
Yeah, I don't love the Transmogrify decks. I think that the Transmogrify setup is... I have found whatever you are hitting to be underwhelming. Like, this is the same problem a lot of the creativity decks have with, like... Especially, like, think of the Atraxa creativity decks where, like, so often you just, like, hit an Atraxa and die. I think a lot of the same problems are present there. And, like... Also, you just have exposed yourself to, like, an entire class of interaction. And also, all the cards that you put in your deck to enable Transmogrify are, like, functional cards that you might want to play, but, like, aren't actually good. Like, this is, again, looping back to the whole Asika's Chariot problem, like, you just have these draws of, like, this card makes a token, and this card makes a token, and all that I've accomplished is, like, making a thing that died to a removal spell and being behind.
Yeah, I find with the Transmogrify decks that... Transmogrify feels like the weak link a lot of the time, and I just want to be some fire deck that's doing a bunch of stuff in that space. And then Transmogrify is just some way of filling out those last few slots, but none of the other options for how to do that really appeal to me instead. I do think Attractor itself is a meaningful upgrade over Agent of Treachery or whatever the other options were, which, like, yeah, the ceiling on Agent is higher, but often you hated to draw that card, and you often couldn't justify firing off an early Transmogrify on Agent because they didn't have anything good to steal yet, so you kind of had to wait around to the point where they could probably hold up mana for their removal spell anyway, so there was some tricky tension there, whereas you are perfectly happy to just fire off Atraxa as soon as possible and then see where that takes you.
Yeah, and again, this the same Atraxa problem as always, and just, like, playing for the setup combo kills in this day and age is, like, you need to be doing something that actively ends the game on the spot, or you should just be playing a normal card, because the normal cards just have that much impact.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, after that brief interlude on the five color decks, some quick hits, decks which were relevant factors 4 or 5 months ago, but have kind of disappeared since then. Phoenix would be the big one. Like, this used to be a tier one staple of Pioneer, and even as recently as that RC cycle, this was one of the decks to beat, maybe one of the decks to play, and it had, by the time of the Pro Tour, basically vanished and hasn't really come back since then. I think if it was going to, this might be the time, because I think it's naturally very well set up against Convoke, good against some of these other decks that have popped up in the interim, including, like, Grease Fang, and I think you can build Phoenix to be good against green. The sticking point will continue to be, though, the Rakdos matchup, and I'm not sure if there's actually a good way of fixing that.
Yeah, I don't think the deck has enough edge anywhere else for it to be worth trying to fix it either. Like, it's not ahead against the metagame.
And you really have to work hard for all of those edges, too, and this is a point which... friend of the show, why not? Nathan Sawyer mentioned in our interview with him was that he had kind of put down Phoenix at the point where he felt like those edges, but if you were playing 100%, you could maybe unlock them, but that was too hard to realize. And if that's too hard for him, it is almost certainly too hard for you, dear listener, out there listening to this.
Yeah, and I mean, again, you're unlocking all these edges to go from 43 to 47%. Like, it's not... Yeah, no.
Yeah. The moment that the Convoke deck took off, I saw someone posting, you know, a picture of Bishop of Wings in a Discord channel with the thinking face emoji. It did get me thinking, but I'm not sure if once that hype dies down, the Angels hype is going to die down with it.
Bishop, okay. Angels, nah.
No? Like, categorically, no?
I don't think it's categorically, but this whole problem with, like, the next tier of decks, like, it has a lot of the same weak matchups as Rakdos Sacrifice, with some more specific upsides, but, like, you're still going to struggle against all these combo decks. And it's just, like, not covering the spread against aggro decks the way it needs to be. That's just not
Yeah, I mean,
about.
the most successful Pioneer deck, limited portion aside, a PT Phyrexia was the Angels deck with a bunch of Llanowar Elves and so on, which was an interesting concept, and I think is now like the stock approach to Angels, but the stock approach to Angels isn't saying much because there just is no Angels. I think that has not really fixed the underlying weaknesses there, and I think the deck is behind against green, and no amount of like pithy needle nonsense or whatever is going to fix that. I think Rakdos, if it cares, is good against you, and you know, they all have a bunch of like sideboard sweepers and more removal these days, and God forbid the opponent ever play an irrigated farmland, right? Like, this is the classic Convoke versus Blue White Squeezer we mentioned from this weekend, where it is very hard to be good against both, and the decks that are best against one often are like heinously bad against the other.
Yeah, the thing looking at the Angels deck that's the most impressive is that it's got a 15 card sideboard and none of them are good in the bad matchups. It's just like, here are 15 cards that help me go from like 53 to 56% anywhere else, because, oh gosh, we're not fixing any of those negative percents.
Yeah, my experience playing Angels against any kind of combo deck is I bought in a ton of these, you know, Archon of Mirrors or Redains, Tomix, Skyclave Apparitions against stuff like Monogreen, and I almost want to be just some generic Green White Company deck, but the thing I signed up for was to be a deck that just has a bunch of these, like, vestigial Angels left in my deck, where I guess I'm going to play Giada as a Grizzly Bear, because that's all it's going to be this game.
Yeah, the deck, again, this is another problem. Like, the Greasebane deck had this issue, but, like, it actually does something powerful. This deck has the issue of, like, every card you bring into your deck cuts away from your linear plan so hard that it's just, it's a real struggle to justify actually sideboarding a lot of the time.
Other quick hits, Gruul Vehicles was a factor last time, kind of dropped off the face of the earth. Still great against Rakdos, although a little less so now. I think just suffers too much elsewhere. Like, Lotus matchup is really bad. I think that I could see it actually being pretty decent against Convoke, but I don't know if that's a matchup anyone's going to be testing anytime soon. Pretty bad against Creativity. I think pretty exploitable by prepared opponents across the board, and it's kind of difficult to depolarize your matchups. I think inherently your deck is just kind of slanted one way.
Yeah, I think we're just talking about a lot of decks that were very good during this like first big sweep of Pioneer events, because the metagame was tilted in a direction that is like very opposite of what it is now.
Yes. And then, is there anything else, Rich? We have covered a lot of ground, I think, but Pioneer is a very broad format. Are there any wildcards which you think, I guess, either deserve to be mentioned or deserve not to be mentioned, but, or rather, deserve to be mentioned in a derogatory fashion?
I mean, people are winning with Mono Black, and I am interested to see if there's, like, anything to, like, Rakdos has been the stock for so long, but I kind of wonder, like, outside of Fable, which red cards you necessarily need or want.
I will say, I have never been less impressed by the card Bonecrusher Giant, and so, beyond that, I mean, Bloodtithe Harvester is a good two, which is kind of irreplaceable, I think, but Fable is the one you struggle to get past, and like Phyrexian Arena is not it, but I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it is a I'm not telling people to play Mono Black, I'm just saying that like we just explored the exact same thing happening in Standard. We should probably think for a minute about applying it again to a different format.
Yes. Any decks which you think deserve to be mentioned in a more optimistic way?
That was about as optimistic as I get for the rest of the metagame, I'm not going to lie.
Okay, I was tempted slash derailed this past weekend seeing the Blue-White Lotus Field deck actually do pretty well at an RCQ, where, and maybe the takeaway there is just Strict Proctor is kind of fucked up against a lot of these creature decks, so including Convoke, but also like Humans and Spirits and, I mean, God forbid, Angels, but a bunch of the other decks too, any of the 4-color, 5-color Leyline Binding decks, a lot of them just, the takeaway might just be like, play a deck that can support Harshbringer or something instead, but I don't know, that part of the equation looked good, and then you kind of go over the top of the other mid-rangey decks because Lotus Field, if you can cheat it out, gives you the resources to be, you know, cycling Big Shot Typhoons and flashing back Memory Deluge two turns ahead of time and juices up your Teferis and so on. Like, I don't know, that deck has always looked better on paper than it is, but it looked good on virtual paper, I suppose, to me.
Yes, I feel like you're exposing yourself to like all the weaknesses of Blue-White and any cyborg cards that people have against the normal Lotus Field decks.
That is a very valid criticism, which I will try to internalize before
you submit too much time it for the tournament upcoming.
But just throwing it out there for anyone at home who may be listening. So I think that will cover it for our Broad People Pioneer. What would you register if you had to play your RC or mine, I suppose, this coming weekend?
Rakdos. I am not trying to get fancy. I'm just trying to Rakdos people. Maybe you could convince me that, like, if everyone I'm testing with says Rakdos is horrible and they don't want to play it, there would be, like, 30 people, and then I'd be like, I'm going to play Blue-White, because none of y'all are playing Rakdos, and, like, who is actually going to play it? That's good if all of you are not.
Would Jarvis yell at you for how you built your Rakdos deck, or are you safe for the time being?
I am extremely safe for the time being.
Is that because you're just net decking Jarvis, or...?
That would be the starting point, yes, but also you could not, like... It's going to take a lot for me to register the first Castle Lockthwain, and you might have to pay me actual money to get a second one in there.
Let alone
three. Like, I don't even know how we got to that point, but that is too far gone.
Yes. So with that, let's move into our results and nonsense segment for the week, which I think once again will be somewhat entangled here, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But dipping our toe back in Modern, what would you say the main stories are from the weekend?
Well, one of the main stories is that Thiago Saporito was in Minneapolis and won an event. I mean, playing Rhinos, but yeah, that was kind of an interesting spot to see him. It's a little further north than I expected him to be.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why he was there. He actually made a deep run in the Saturday event as well, and the Saturday events, the 10K showdowns, do qualify you if you win for their end of year championship. So the question then becomes, like, well, I assume Thiago is hopping on a flight from Brazil for that, for just like a 32 player 25K or whatever if he can, but it's a bit of a longer flight than anyone else is gonna have.
Yeah. I guess to sort of wrap up that, so he won with Rhinos. There was a ton of Rhinos in that event. The same list is still winning a lot. We also see Five Color Zoo doing pretty well this weekend, and I think that something I kind of alluded to is that this is like a pretty good time for like generic large threats in Modern, because my issue with Five Color Zoo was one of two things. One is that like you would play against decks like, I don't know, like the specifically the like Omneth and Raghavan decks like are very specific in forcing you to be as efficient as possible, and they are slightly inefficient and just get rolled by those decks. The representation of those is down, and then also like there's a subclass of decks like Tron that are very like just like you tap two mana for Territorial Kabu and they're like, here's a Karn, like why are you tapping two mana for like a creature with power and toughness and nothing else, and then you die. That's not really where the format is. It's a lot more mid-rangey, so like that deck has looked pretty impressive, and like the sizing on Kavu against all these Rhinos matters, and also like Hidetsugu Consumes All is pretty okay right now. Like it's very impressive, and this is the best deck for it.
Yeah, I still don't really understand the appeal of the Domain Zoo deck. I think you sign up for a lot of mana issues for not that much gain, but I could believe that at least for this tournament, the deck was well positioned, because we did see the unfortunate Zoo player meet their demise at the hands of Yawgmoth, where they, in a post-sideboard game, had their Ragavan blanked by Young Wolf and then tried to summon Denial of Grist. And I'm assuming if that's any indication that the deck's positioning, at least, must have been pretty good for the tournament.
Yeah, I think that just like if you look at a lot of these effects, you can kind of view them as this downstream of like, is it started losing, but there was a ton of Rakdos. And then Rakdos has stopped showing up at the winning tables quite as much. So, like, there's just this lack of the pressures of Raghavan and Blood Moon on the format. And people are starting to explore directions that are, like, fine because of that. I think that another deck that, like, started showing up in the Magic Online results a bit that has been, like, really in the dumpsters of the Magic Online results is it Breach, like, showing up again, where, like, I don't really want to be the Breach player against the other Raghavan decks, but if I'm trying to play against people who are, like, not trying to play a symmetrical game plan to me, it's a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what the rest of the format has in store for you, like, I think Rhinos is pretty tricky, as Oliver Tomiko proved in his televised grudge match, and then a lot of the other matchups just... It's kind of hard to find the spot where you want to be the Breach deck, and if anything, you might almost take your chances against the other Ragavan decks, because definitionally your decks are similar enough that, like, the matchup can't be that hard, whereas And once you get to that point, I think, yeah, you may as well just put it down and pick up something else.
Yeah. Let's see. Other notable stuff from this set of results. Nissa has basically become, like, you play as many Nissas as you can reasonably get yourself to do at, where you would play Risen Reefs and then fill out the rest. So there's a lot of, like, 2-2 splits and 3-2 splits in these four-color decks. Makes a lot of sense, even though it does feel like only playing, like, two Risen Reef is pretty bad, because a lot of the upside in Risen Reef is the double Risen Reef setups, it always felt to me. So, like, I kind of just want to cut that card. It doesn't have good colors. Like, it doesn't pitch to anything. Like, what's it doing?
Risen Reef really wants you to play four copies of itself, whereas Nissa is a lot more tolerant in that regard. And you can't really play both, so you have to choose. And so you maybe choose the card which gives you more leeway. And also, if you draw exactly one copy, is going to be more reliable and less fragile a lot of the time.
Yep, that all checks out.
Yeah, I've tried sketching lists that just have both, because in theory, you can really go hard on the elementals angle. You just kind of run out of space pretty quickly once you start doing that. And the other issue with Reef is not only do you want to play four Reef, but then that encourages you in turn to play maybe more copies of some of the elementals than you would organically. So we've seen some four-color lists with like two Furies, right? If I'm playing Risen Reef, I kind of want to push that towards four if I can, but then that's six slots that are up in the air that are spoken for instead of four. So if instead I can play 2-3 Nissa and then maybe still only play 2-3 Fury, well, now I have more spots for like another Teferi or another, you know, fill in the blank, however you like.
Yeah, I think another, like I said, bad colors, like you're putting a lot of blue green and green cards into your deck that is trying to pitch cards to the elementals a lot, and you start running into problems there.
Moving beyond the various five-color, four-color decks, you've mentioned that just classic Burn, but not so classic in the sense of Eidolon, one of the longtime Burn staples. We saw that challenge-winning deck that the cut Eidolon altogether. This might be just the case of people just copying the list that did well the previous week, and then that does well this week, and so the people next week are doing the same, and that just compounds on itself. But maybe this is actually the new way to build the deck. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is. Eidolon is a like slow card that is not reliable for actual damage, and like when you are really scrapping at the margins every game, I think it's pretty important to play cards that actually deal damage reliably. Also, like if you look at how Eidolon pairs up, like a lot of the decks where Eidolon would just kill your opponent aren't in the metagame anymore because they lose to everything else. Like, it is sometimes good for damage against the Cascade decks, and that's about it.
Yeah, I guess my perhaps mistaken impression was always that in the matchups where Eidolon is good, it's kind of essential almost for actually counting to 20 reliably, and that even in the matchups where it's bad, it can only be so bad because, like, they're still going to be casting spells that cost 1-3, right? Like, it's kind of hard to avoid that game altogether. And so sometimes you'll board it out, but that's a rarity. And when it's good, like, you actually would play many more than four copies if you could. But I don't know, maybe the metagame really has got to such a place where that trade-off just doesn't balance anymore.
The problem is that even in the matchups where you're like, yeah, well, it's just going to, like, oh, they're going to play some number of spells. Like, a lot of those are decks that are also pressuring you. And I've had this experience where the power level has crept enough where, like, half the time you play Eidolon, it's bad for you in some way, shape, or form.
Sure. I mean, at that point, my inclination would be to just not play Burn, but if people are winning challenges despite that, then I guess you can just keep doing that anyway.
Yeah, I think that the deck has just, like, pushed itself back from, like, falling off to Tier 3 to, like, decently solidly Tier 2.
Yes. So now we get to really blur the line between results and nonsense, because Yargle and Multani is not just at it, it's back at it, I suppose.
Yeah, no, this deck's really good. This, like, when I'm saying, like, I alluded to I'm not playing a good deck right now, I'm playing this deck. This deck is, like, actually legitimate.
Okay.
Like, to the point that I wonder if for 2 years, like, maybe we haven't played this deck. Maybe 2 years is an exaggeration. Let's say a year. I think that, like, if you were to timeline out when this deck became viable, it was when they banned Yorion and 20% of the field didn't just have Teferi in their main deck, and then you could play Profane Tutor without looking like a doofus. And I think after that point, there's a really, like, you probably should have just built this deck this way with the Cremators and, like, played Impervious Great Worm instead of, like, whatever people were doing with Grizzlebrands. Like, it is everything that people say about the Is It Breach deck, this deck is living the same thing, where, like, you have, like, these four game plans that are all, like, very interlocking and powerful that, like, you kind of just execute two of them in every single game, and like it's very hard for your opponent to cover them all. Like, if you look at the sideboard, it is so disrespectful to any idea that your opponent might play a card that attacks your graveyard, because you just don't care. Like, it's like, I don't know, if your opponent plays a Rest in Peace, just discard your Gorya's Vengeance to Fable, or like kill them with Cremator. Like, who cares? Yeah, there's like all these problems of the Asmo decks that were like, oh, I'm gonna run out of cards in hand. And this deck's like, oh, I run out of cards in hand? Perfect. The last one's an 18-6, and there's another one on the stack. Good luck.
Yeah, I think so. On the Impervious Greatworm point, I think the fact that you can't Gorya's Vengeance that is a big deal, and maybe a less big deal is like when there is a difference between 16 and 18, that can be a game deciding difference. So the Yogal and Multani like might actually be like the piece holding the room together here. But I think it's like we have featured the Cremator decks generally as nonsense of the week in the past, and then the Asmo Gorya decks have been on the radar, but always as, oh well, that's just Sorceress back at his old tricks or something of that nature. So to see a fusion of those two decks, naturally your first response is going to be, well, this is like a one-hit wonder, very cool, love to see it, don't expect to see it again. And so the fact that you've like we've broken past that conditioning and now we're actually treating this as this deck is real, this deck is here to stay, it is impressive. Maybe that is a sign of something.
Yeah, it just like all the things just work together. Like it's very impressive. The only thing I'll say is that it is often like a bit precise. Like every Kragnewit Cremator kill is often like very precise, because it's like you are starting from a point where like two or three turns out, you know you are trying to end up with exactly one or two cards in your hand, and those cards all have 15 or 18 power. And like there's just a lot of work to be done there to get to that point. And like then like there's the games where you're supposed to realize where you're not going to get to that point and just fire it off and hope. I don't know. It's just like think a bit more about like it is very traditional combo-y where like a lot of the setup lines are very punishing for missing on what you're supposed to do.
Yes, there's a lot of planning two turns out where like I guess Cookbook makes it a little bit easier. You can just surgically discard whatever you want every turn, but otherwise you do sometimes have to get quite creative or have the foresight to realize this is how I get this roadblock of sorts out of my hand to actually turn the Cremator kill from 85% to 100%, or from, you know, maybe 85% is the best you can do sometimes, but like getting from 60% to there is a big upgrade in its own right.
Yeah, I think it's more like it's like Cookbook, but like you have to like, when are you casting your Cookbook versus taking other game actions? When are you playing your Urza Saga to find your Cookbook, but also like have four mana on the Cremator turn? Are you trying to get like specific creatures on the battlefield so that your Saga can find the Springleaf Drum and mana boost you to that? Like, there's just a lot of weird stuff that is in the background.
So that is a former nonsense deck that has reached the status of official legitimate deck and will now be treated with the reverence that it deserves. We do still have some actual nonsense of the week to get to here, though.
Yeah, so you talked about Shark Typhoon enthusiasts, and X-File is at it again and may be the biggest Shark Typhoon enthusiast of all, with a top 16 in a challenge with Omen Hawker, the old Cephalid yes. Advisor.
Yeah, not quite a Ragavan in terms of broken mana producing one drops, but we're going to give it a fair shot here. So, you would think in a card pool spanning 20 years of sets, there's going to be a lot of stuff that Omen Hawker can do. And so, if you can build around that and start activating it consistently on, you know, turn two, turn three, that's pretty appealing. So, X-File has gone deep in the tank and come up with like Wizard Tribal almost. So we have Step Through, where you can use a two mana to pay for the Wizard Cycling two there to find any of Jace Prince Prodigy, Snapcaster Mage, which there's a decent amount of overlap there, but I guess sometimes you want one rather than the other. Nimble Obstructionist, which is both a wizard and also a very good use for your Omen Hawker mana. And then the one that really tickles me is Magus of the Moon, which I had forgot was a wizard, because usually that is by far the least relevant part of the entire card, but it is highly relevant here, and so you can make that highly relevant for some of your opponents when you so choose.
Yeah, there's a lot, like, I don't really know what these Muddle the Mixtures in the deck are here for, but they're doing stuff, and, like, the Sage's Dowsing, certainly a card that exists.
It sure is. So this is, for people who weren't playing, you know, it in standard Merfolk back in the day, this is a tribal instant, 2 and a blue, counter target spell unless its controller pays 3, and if you control a wizard, draw a card, which it's not actually that easy to control a wizard in this deck. So there's Omen Hawker and the Obstructionist, which often you're cycling instead, and then the a few selected one-off wizards, but sometimes it is a mana leak and you're okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, Step
and
through,
it's also
Step Through's a wizard, oh, hold right? Up.
What's that?
Step Through's a wizard, right?
Sure. I see. The angle I didn't consider was, this is good types of Unholy Heat.
Oh, that is cute. I hadn't thought about that. All your other spells are, like, really instant heavy, so maybe that is really important.
Yeah, that probably a good reason we haven't seen, like, Tarfire setting up Unholy Heat in a hot minute, but, you know, we can bypass that for now. The other deck you have listed here as four-color Omnath, which I suppose is technically true, which is the best kind of true.
Yeah, it's four colors, and there's an Omnath in the deck. There's yes. also a wall... Like, I think the real nonsense starts when you realize there's a Wall of Blossoms and a Wall of Omens, and then also it's a Lutri Companion deck. So I just wanted to look at the full spread of options available in four-color with this deck that finished, sadly, in ninth place in a challenge in the hands of Wombo Combo 2020.
Yeah, so notorious Zuma, who was thought to be retired until recently, but I guess is back up to their old tricks. And even the mana base is gesturing in some kind of singleton direction here. Like, we obviously have the four Misty Rainforest and the four Windswept Heath and so on, but we have, like, one of each snow-covered basic, and then one of each of a bunch of Shocklands, and a Triumph here, a Triumph there, the one beside you. This is, if you ignore some of the numbers, this could look like a one-off mana base too.
Yeah, my favorite part of this deck is I don't even know what I'm really meant to be copying with Lutri. Like, so March, right? March of Otherworldly Light and Prismatic Ending are both, like, rather precise and hard to copy with Lutri on two things. Spell Pierce, Mana Leak, like, Remand, those, like, it's very rare that you want to copy a counterspell. I don't think copying Bring to Light works the way you want it to.
Yes, which, like, I'm not sure I will be in a position to be disappointed by that, given the setup requirements, but good to know that ahead of time.
You can copy Supreme Verdict to kill all the undying creatures, I guess. Like, it's very funny that this is a Lutri deck, because it's just, like, I don't know, like, you're copying Consider at the end of the day.
Yeah, like, Traverse the Uvenbod, I suppose, but that's really it. It's, like, it's a tiny handful of cards in a deck that has a lot of different cards to write down on your deck list.
Maybe this is just more a statement about 4-color being able to play whatever cards it wants in some configuration and basically accomplishing the same game plan via vibes.
This is modern art, is what you're saying
exactly.
Here.
Exactly.
Yes. So on that beautiful artistic note, I think we will finally leave it there for the week. You can find us on Twitter at Dom and Javier at ARMLX. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment. You can find our content on SEG and then CFB/TCG player. Respectively, and you can find us discussing various different nonsensical Kragnarok cremated decks and many other things over in the Discord. So the link to all of those things and many more will be in the show notes. We will be back next week for our 100th episode spectacular. We still haven't decided quite what we're doing for that yet, and the answer may be just nothing. It's a normal episode. Why would we care? But you will learn that when we all do, when you come back this time next week. Take care, everyone.